I was born 100 years ago, 1911. Another important thing happened that year. Three companies took a bold step and created the Computing Tabulating Recording Company. And the world was about to get a whole lot smarter.
By 1912, the year I was born, the company already has 1,300 employees.
1913, the company's Hollerith tabulating machine, once used only in census taking, is now applied to industry.
In 1914, 76 years before the American Disabilities Act was passed, they hire their first disabled worker.
In 1915, the best man for the job of president is Thomas J. Watson.
Mr. Watson believes that all the problems of the world can be settled easily if people are only willing to think.
1917, Brazil. 1918, 3,000 employees. Growth.
1919, the electronic synchronized time clock.
The first printing tabulator.
The job ticket printing machine.
The Carroll Rotary Card Press.
The electric key punch.
By 1924, as a way to signal the company's future ambitions, Watson changes the name of the company to International Business Machines, IBM.
Egypt goes dark, Sony backdoors your PS3, and Apple tightens the screws. All that and more on the Slongcast. Hello and welcome to the Slongcast, episode 21 for Tuesday, February 1st, 2011. As always, I'm your host, Kevin Slonka, and with me today, I have two people in the studio. Second week in a row, we got two people. To my right, Mr. Ryan Lancey.
Hey, how you doing?
I am wonderful. How are you?
Pretty good. Just partying about the IBM's.
I know, that was awesome.
Yeah, happy birthday, IBM.
Happy birthday. And to my left, first time on the show, Mr. Matt Hunt.
Hey, thanks for having me, Kevin, and happy Groundhog Eve.
Oh, that's tomorrow, isn't it?
It sure is.
Holy crap.
It'll be like in a short few hours, they'll pull him out of his little cave.
That's, yeah, he has to chisel the ice out before he makes it out of the hole, I think.
Yeah. He's not going to be able to get out. So, Matt, since it's your first time here, why don't you tell everybody a little bit about who you are, what you do?
Yeah, by background, I'm a astrophysicist. I work for a local company and do a lot of varied work with sensor systems and IT and all kinds of things.
Holy crap.
A real live astrophysicist.
I know, right?
Yes.
I feel like this is the Big Bang Theory, except only one of us has a doctorate.
Only one of us really knows how that actually works.
Right.
I'm glad to be here.
Thank you very much. All right, so let's jump right in. The biggest story of the past week, Egypt shut off the internet. I'm assuming you guys have heard about this.
I didn't know.
Really?
Well, I mean, how did anyone hear about it if they shut it off?
Somebody on Twitter mentioned it, I think.
Oh, the news, Ryan, the news.
Okay.
But a lot of protests going on in Egypt, and the government there figured out that a lot of the protests would be started via Twitter and social networking. And they're like, you know what? If this is how it's going to go, we're shutting off the internet. So they shut off, or they told two of the biggest ISPs. Basically, Egypt has three ISPs, you know, very few. So they told two of them.
Is it like Comcast, Verizon, and Quest?
I think they're also government owned, aren't they?
Yeah. Yeah, so the government can tell them what to do. So they're just like, hey, shut it off. So the two biggest ones, they turned off. I don't know if they actually turned off the routers or just turned off the BGP protocol, the routing protocol. But within a couple minutes, no traffic. Not a lot of traffic getting into Egypt. And then the next article kind of goes along with this, that the last internet service provider, which had the remaining 8% who were still on the internet, just shut them off. So now Egypt is totally black.
They're dark.
So what do you guys think about, I mean, this is ridiculous.
One thing that impressed me after reading the article is that they actually took steps so that they wouldn't affect downstream countries. So they're allowing pass-through traffic. If there's any like backbone fiber that goes through Egypt, the traffic on the other end of it still will get through.
Yeah, I didn't see it, but did they mention what traffic passes through Egypt?
No, I didn't see a list of countries.
Yeah, that would have been interesting to see. But Matt, what do you think about this country having power to do something like this?
Well, it is a dictatorship.
Well, okay, and, yeah.
if you have a dictatorship that owns the ISPs, it's not really surprising that they can do this. Technologically, it's not surprising. And when you have, you know, people uprising and you have an army with tanks facing them down, it's not surprising that they would take this step. It does give you something to think about in terms of whether our own country could do this or if, you know, there would be technological alternatives. If you were there in Egypt, would you be able to get a message out or not? Could you do it over sat phone? Could you get close enough to a border that you could reach some other ISP?
Right. And that's what a lot of people were doing, you know, bringing out their modems and dialing into other countries to get on the internet.
Yeah. There's RFC 1149, IP over carrier pigeon.
That is,
you know,
always
a backup. It's so cool to hear Matt talk about that because no one believes me that actually exists. But it does. It does. There's actually a refinement of it, I think, later on, a couple years later.
Yeah, and there were field trials also.
Really?
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, packet loss was severe, but they got a signal through. Latency is also really bad.
You're not going to game over that.
Skype, wow. I hear, is really laggy. Ooh, yeah.
That would be rough.
I want to start my... I'd like to write an RFC about this, too. It's called MPP-IP, Massively Parallel Pigeon Carrier over IP.
So. Ooh. Well, they do flock.
Yeah. But anyway.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, that was exactly the point that I was going to bring up, not about the pigeons, but about, you know, whether or not our country could do something like this. And, you know, that's actually been talked about in the news, giving Obama the kill switch, per se, for our internet.
Yeah.
I mean, what do you guys think of that? Just
bad.
Giving our... Really? You think it's completely bad?
Terrible, awful. I mean, I think the ability of people to speak their mind is the fundamental, like, root of a free country. And in today's world, the internet is a way to speak your mind.
Yeah, I agree. And aside from that, I don't think you're going to cut it off 100% no matter what. You still have people like ham radio operators who will do packet radio. There's going to be other communication lines that are open
right.
No matter what you do.
Yeah, you get a couple Yagi antennas and some like hacked firmware on a RT54G, you know, and you can send a pretty decent signal, high bandwidth signal, about 15 miles, you know.
Yeah, and so what about the kill switch in terms of protecting our country, you know, from internet attacks, that they would be able to shut off communications so the Chinese can't hack us and take down our critical systems? Because you know that's going to be the reason they give as to why they want to do this. They're not going to say, we want to take away your freedoms. They're going to say, we want to protect you. Do you think that's a real option?
I think there's some merit to that argument, but really so much depends on a functioning internet at this point that it's hard to imagine how bad the situation would have to be for that to be the appropriate response. You know, the same thing came up with GPS where we had selective availability and the ability to degrade GPS. Then everybody started depending on it for civil aviation and everything else. And
yeah.
And they started to realize that this isn't something we can just turn off on a whim. There's too many people counting on it. And I think the same is true of the internet, even more so.
Yeah, literally everything runs over the internet, whether people know it or not. You know, everything. Credit cards. You know, how do you make a credit card transaction at Walmart?
Well, they got the slidey thing, right?
Oh, the slidey thing.
Yeah.
I forgot about the slidey things.
Yeah. Actually, I've seen some credit cards that don't even have the raised numbers anymore, though.
Yeah.
I was purchasing something somewhere and somebody had one and the cashier commented, I don't know what we're going to do when there's a power outage, you know.
That's true.
Well, I guess their cash machine probably wouldn't work either.
Yeah, that is also true. So you can only pay via credit cards if you have an old credit card with the raised numbers.
Yes.
Or barter. I'm bringing my chickens.
That's what I'm missing. I don't have anything to barter with.
Yeah, you city folk.
I'll be screwed. Yeah. All right, so moving on, our next article is something that really struck me as odd. I don't know if any of you guys watched the video attached to this article, but apparently in the likes of Polaroid hiring Lady Gaga, Intel hired Will.i.am from the Black Eyed Peas to be their director of creative innovation, a new title they made specifically for him. Did either of you watch the video that went along with this? Or any of the videos?
I actually didn't, because I didn't see the video at the, on the article.
Oh.
Yeah, I'm afraid not.
Well, either way, if you would have watched the videos, you would have wondered how this guy passed high school. Like, he can't speak. It's just funny to give him such a prestigious title at Intel, no less, and he has trouble constructing a sentence. But that aside, since you guys didn't actually hear him speak, what do you think about this whole trend of companies hiring, you know, music or just celebrities in general to do something with their products to make them quote unquote hip again?
Well, I mean, I think he's probably just going to put some boom, boom, pow into Intel's
boom,
product.
Boom, pow.
Yeah, exactly. No, I mean, if you can find somebody that can connect with a generation and sort of like Dr. Dre has this Beats audio thing that he's hooked up with Hewlett Packard. And, like, I guess Hewlett-Packard laptops are cool again.
And from what I hear, that's actually a really good sound system.
Yeah, I haven't heard it, and I like to be the judge of that myself.
That's true. Not from what I've heard in person, from what I've heard other people talking about.
Right. And it, I could see some, especially pop music artists that could definitely connect with a younger generation.
I just wonder what this has to do with Intel, like with teaming up with HP and Beats, making the Beats audio. Good, that's what he does. He does music. He's making this. Intel makes processors. What is a singer from the Black Eyed Peas going to do with processors?
Well, now with Sandy Bridge and everything, you have integrated graphics, which includes the audio portion, so you can do, bits stream out through HDMI, stuff like that, right?
Uh-huh.
So even their CPUs are now transitioning to the integrated multimedia.
So they're going to use him to make Sandy Bridge the next big thing.
So, well, basically, I think like every new PC that comes with an Intel processor will have the entire catalog, back catalog of the Black Eyed Peas built in.
That's that extra 3 million transistors in the corner, right?
Right, exactly.
That is true. Microsoft does like to put, whenever you first open Windows Media Player, they have random songs from random artists already saved on your computer. That wouldn't surprise me if you open up Windows Media Player on the next machine and it comes with the Black Eyed Peas album.
Well, you remember Weezer was what, Windows 95?
Weezer, that's
Buddy,
right.
Buddy Holly.
Buddy Holly.
I forgot about that.
Yeah, there was one other video that came with it too. I can't think of the other one, but yeah, I do remember the Buddy Holly video.
Whatever happened to Weezer?
Whatever happened to Windows 95?
Well,
Weezer's stuck around a little bit better.
Yeah, they have.
Windows 95 was all right. I think Windows ME killed it.
Windows ME killed a lot of things.
Our sanity. So this next article, Ryan, I believe you submitted it.
So Slashdot decided to launch a new user interface. I mean, I think we're all probably Slashdot visitors occasionally, at least. I usually hit the site once a day. Slashdot's if people aren't familiar, it's probably one of the first social tech news websites.
It's definitely the first one I heard of.
Yeah, it's not quite social. Like, in the sense that from first impressions of it, doesn't seem like it's very social. But, you click a link and then you get a list of comments and you can submit stories. And if you go into the recent and recent section, you can vote on stories. But what do you think about the redesign? I really like it.
I do like the redesign. I think it's a lot cleaner. One thing that I never understood, and I still don't, I believe they did this in the last redesign. The scoring bar and the way they rate comments now, and I don't understand what any of that is. Like, I just want them to go back to story comments. I don't know what this other stuff is they have on the page.
Yeah, Slashdot and I go way back. I have a 4-digit user ID on
oh,
Slashdot.
Wow.
And frankly, what's the rating of this podcast? Do we get the explicit tag?
We can.
I don't give an F anymore.
Wait, that doesn't make us.
Yeah. It's like breaking hearts in hearts, right? I don't want to be the first one. So, I've been reading Slashdot forever. And what I noticed a few months ago is that everything from Slashdot that came through my RSS feed, I'd seen 12 to 24 hours earlier somewhere else.
Right.
And it just doesn't do it for me anymore. It used to be that the comments were really great. You had NASA geeks and everyone else commenting on the site, And now the stories come in late, and if I click through the comments, there's nothing there.
Well, let me take you up on that one point. Do you think that the stories are coming in late, or do you think that we're just so used to sites like Dig, where there are no editors to promote stories to the front page, whereas Slashdot, they still use that editor system, that they're just taking forever for an editor to see it and promote it?
You know, I see your point, but I actually don't do a lot of Dig or Reddit or anything like that. I'm seeing stuff in, you know, Ars Technica, Gizmodo, edited sites, and they're still coming through a lot faster than Slashdot.
Right.
And it just doesn't do much for me anymore.
Yeah, I think if you're an Ars Technica reader, you're already getting the best of the best when it comes to tech news. I mean, and I'm talking like tech news at a really high level too, not like, oh, Windows 7 came out. It's like, you know, here's how the new Sandy Bridge processor works, like, or the new, you know, Nehalem architecture from Intel. It's really just really detailed. And I think you're right on that point. I do agree. I all the other websites that I've seen, Slashdot's always behind the curve. I still do appreciate some of the comments that I see there, though, occasionally.
Yeah, I probably don't click through often enough to see some of the good stuff, and I probably should, but it's also not like it was in 2000 or 2003.
Yeah.
Same, it's like The Simpsons, you know?
It was definitely a long need of a revamp, though. Look-wise, I think it looks a lot better, and maybe that'll attract some people back.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, I'm more jaded. Maybe jaded isn't the right word, but I use Dig a lot. That's where I have Dig and Slashdot and a couple other sites in my Google Reader, and I just find so much more stuff on Dig coming through. And, you know, like you said, you see stuff other places quicker. I'll see stuff from Dig at the beginning of the day when I first get to work, and then before I go home, I'll check again, and finally that same article shows up on Slashdot.
It's like,
I'm so used to things happening faster now, Slashdot doesn't cut it anymore.
Yeah, and I still have a soft spot for Slashdot. I'd love to see them get back at the top.
Well, your user ID, I mean, yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, and my username is my initials.
Right? Oh. So.
Well, you guys can hate all you want, but I, for one, welcome our new Slashdot theme overlords.
All right, so our next article is kind of interesting. Yahoo is firing again, but Google is hiring more than ever. So I think we're seeing this in a lot of the tech industry, that it's a time for growth. You're seeing a lot of startups. You're seeing a lot of companies hire a lot of people to do a lot of different new innovative things. But then there's Yahoo, and they're firing a lot of people. What do you guys think of where Yahoo's going and what they're doing now? I see some smirks.
Well, we've talked about this. I think we talked about Yahoo, and does anyone go to Yahoo anymore?
Yeah, I mean, the last article we had was another round of firing that Yahoo did. This is another one.
Yeah, yet another.
Yeah.
I like Yahoo's, I mean, I still think they have some products that are still cool, or maybe not cool, but like usable. But I don't know. I don't know what you say about this. I mean, Google, in terms of search, they own it. I think at one time Yahoo was using Google's search engine, and then they formed a partnership with Bing, right?
Oh, I'm not sure.
I can't remember.
That sounds right.
Yeah. So, I don't know.
Yeah, and here's an interesting thing that I didn't realize until I was watching the most recent episode of Dig Nation, and Kevin Rose was saying that he was contacted by somebody from Yahoo asking him, will you buy Delicious? Just trying to give it a good home. Because Yahoo just can't do it anymore.
It's better than the alternative.
It is. I mean, I want Delicious to stay around. And
oh, yeah. I think I didn't. You actually turned me on to Delicious. I hadn't even heard of it.
Yeah, I never used it until I was getting ready for tonight.
It's great. It's a really great bookmarking website.
I mean, I don't use it like I should use it. Like, it's meant for social bookmarking, so your friends can find what you bookmark. But I just use it as a way because it's a central repository for all my bookmarks. And I love that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm a Firefox guy, so I use Firefox Sync for my own bookmarking, or for temporary stuff, I use Read It Later. But I can see the utility for something like this, where you want to share bookmarks between multiple people.
Right. I actually use that Chrome Sync feature, too, but the Chrome Sync feature is so stupid that it won't sync to your actual Google bookmarks. Yeah, there's like...
Where does it sync?
Google Chrome bookmarks. It's like a separate service from Google. So... You know, Yahoo is not the only company out there that is, you know, is not 100% stupid. I mean, or you know, it has some level of stupidity among it.
Yeah, related to that, when I created my Delicious account, I tied it to my Google ID, which automatically logged me out of my Yahoo session that I had running simultaneously.
Well, I don't even, that's another thing I don't like about Delicious. I have mine associated to my Yahoo account.
So do I.
But like when you go to the login page, you can't log in unless you click sign in with your Yahoo ID. It's like just parse the stupid login IDs. Like
that's weird. I didn't notice that.
Yeah, it's
well, the way I log in, I have an extension for Firefox that puts my Delicious bookmarks in a sidebar, just like the normal bookmarks, and that logs me in automatically, so I never actually go to the page.
Yeah, actually, I created the Delicious account that was linked to my Google OpenID, and then from my work computer, I tried to log into the same Delicious account, and it only gave me the option of logging in with a Yahoo ID, and I actually had to go to Google and Google for log into Delicious with Google ID.
Did you find the answer?
Yes, I
did.
You know, this is one thing that I think Microsoft Passport really would have fixed.
Passport. I forgot about Passport.
Now it's called like Live Sign-In or something.
Yeah, Live ID or whatever.
It was actually not a bad idea, honestly, but...
Well, I don't think any of these things are bad ideas, like OpenID, you know, all of these multi-use logins. It's just getting everybody to get on board is never going to happen. You're always going to have 50 million, you know, user IDs.
Well, with OpenID, it shouldn't matter, right? Because you can pick your OpenID provider. So if you want to use your Google ID, you can use that. If you want to use your Yahoo ID, you can use that. Whatever.
Very interesting.
But most people implement it with a bunch of buttons, right? With the Google button and the Yahoo button and the blah, blah, blah button.
Right.
But in principle, you should have a text entry field with your OpenID URL, right? Which is, you know, can reference any OpenID provider in the world.
Oh.
So what you're saying is that everybody screws up the login process for OpenID.
It's probably hidden there somewhere. I just use my Google one and right. Everybody gives you a Google button.
So. Right. That's true. It's because Google owns the world.
Yep.
While we're talking about Google, though, Google is actually releasing a new extension for Chrome, which is very cool. I am very interested in. I would be very interested in this if I used Chrome. But the extension is called Keep Your Opt-Outs, which is basically a way for you to use this extension and pass a header to different sites to say, you know, don't track me. So it's basically to keep yourself off of ad networks. So you have this extension, you browse some sites, and you can say, do not track me on this site. You have to do it for every site, but it's a way to keep track of that, whereas you really can't do that any other way. And the coolest thing is that they're open sourcing it and hoping that everybody makes it for every browser. So would you guys use something like this? Do you care about advertisers tracking you?
I don't care that much. I run ad blockers, so mostly they don't track me anyway. If I had this feature, I would use it. I wouldn't trust anyone to honor it.
That is true.
Well, I mean, what motivates the advertising networks to honor this?
Oh, absolutely. Well, it's not the advertising networks. It's the individual sites that need to honor it. Mm-hmm. So they would probably get in trouble from the ad networks. The ad networks saying, hey, we're paying you and you're not letting us track stuff. Turn it back on. So I can see that happening and nobody... you know, letting this happen.
Well, I mean, I guess the site would just forgo the revenue from the people that opt out, right?
Right, right.
I don't even know that the ad network would know that it's happening.
I don't think they would. I mean...
they just wouldn't serve up the ad.
Yeah, I'm sure they would see a decline in the ads being served
up. Or maybe not the tracker, sorry.
Yeah, I mean, it might be the ad too, or whatever information they get. So there might just be like this one day when this extension comes out that they see 50% decline in, you know, ad sales or click-throughs or whatever, and they're like, hey, what's going on?
Hmm.
But
well, still, though, we're just talking about the tracking cookies. Like
we are talking about the tracking cookies.
So I guess one way the ad network might know is that they would see a lot of like ads being served but not many tracking cookies working or something.
And right. They'd serve up generic ads instead.
Right. So they'd have, I guess they would have a metric on it.
Right. Yeah. They would have some, they wouldn't know what's going on, but they would see something funny.
Yeah. And well, but the thing is though, the user could have just blocked their cookies. Could just block your cookies, right?
And I think that's, you know, what you brought up, Matt, with ad blocking software that sort of does that sort of thing. So yeah, there are people out there who do that. And yeah. I guess the population who uses Chrome isn't that big anyways to make that much of a difference. I could be wrong. Everybody could use Chrome. I don't know.
Yeah. See, I'm actually on the other side of this a little bit. I think that this is the advertising is the way that they pay for this content. And I think that it's a little bit dishonest, you know, to block all advertising. But That said, there's so much controversy right now over, like, you know, they were talking about this, these caps that happened, the data caps in Canada, and people were like, okay, fine, you can cap my data, but you're not, I'm not paying for the ads to be served up. So it's like it's a weird model we have with the internet. We pay for access, but then the content is paid through advertising. So it's a little strange.
Yeah, it's,
I mean, if nobody sees the ads, the advertisers are going to pull out. We're going to have no content. I mean, or you're going to be Wikipedia with a big freaking banner for half of the year. Please donate. Which
I hate that banner.
I mean, it's fine. I mean, they need donations to stay afloat. I mean, but it's like, do you want that on every website? Well, it's, instead of it being an ad from a third party that you might be interested in, it's an ad from Jimmy Wales.
Jimmy Wales. Well, yeah, we talked about this before on many previous Slongcasts about blocking advertisements, and I don't mind Google AdWords. I hate animated pictures.
Yeah,
Punch the monkey.
I can't deal with that stuff. Also, I'm on a crappy satellite internet connection.
Oh. That
I do not want to deal with downloading that stuff. I'm lucky if my web pages download.
Yeah.
And, you know, besides that, most ads are pay-per-click, right? I have never clicked an ad in my life.
Yeah.
The sites are not getting any more revenue whether they show me the ad or not.
Right.
I understand philosophically that it's advertising supported, and like you, Kevin, I don't mind the Google text ads. That's fine with me. But I'm just not dealing with the, you know, the flashing Punch the Monkey ads. You know, I don't like on TV when we're watching a baseball game and I'm sitting at my computer and suddenly it's three times as loud because somebody wants to sell me a mattress right now.
They actually just passed a law.
Yeah.
So that can't happen anymore.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, that was so annoying.
Yeah. Remember Magnavox had a TV, the smart sound TVs that came out?
No.
Yeah. Back in like the late 80s, early 90s, Magnavox had a technology called smart sound. And John, what's his name? The guy from Monty Python.
Cleese.
John Cleese. He was the advertiser, you know, or spokesman.
Spokesman,
for it.
Yeah.
And, you know, basically it lowered the volume for commercials or, you know, put some form of compression in there.
Nice.
Yeah.
Where did that go?
Yeah. A lot of TVs still have it. People just don't switch it on.
Yeah, or your receivers have like Dolby, forgot they call it, some dynamic range compression.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
Yeah.
Nighttime mode, things like that, sometimes they call it.
They need to resolve this, though. Like, I mean, I think it's actually unfair for these websites to be serving up ads and it's only pay-per-click. I mean, if I view the ad, I think they should get revenue for it. It's like the newspaper. It's how the newspaper works.
Right. You can't click on an ad in a newspaper.
Right.
Yeah, the Google argument is that they are providing a better metric of ad efficacy, right? That the clicks are what count. If people come to your site, that's what counts. And they're doing a better job of tying your revenue from advertising to the outcomes of that advertising, where it used to be this sort of mystical black box where advertisers said, yeah, we'll create ads and it'll help you, but we can't quantify how.
Right. Well, I wonder how Google's, I mean, I don't know a lot about the advertising market, even though I do watch Mad Men.
So you know everything.
Yeah. Well, no, but I mean, I know everything about advertising in 1964. So, but I mean, I wonder how Google's doing versus some of these older advertising companies that, you know, that mainstream, in terms of like making money for their clients and making money themselves in the ad. I mean, I know Google makes a lot of money. I mean, what percentage of their revenue is ad based? Is it all of it?
Virtually all. I think it's 90 something percent of Google's revenue is ad based.
It's so
crazy.
They are
an advertising company.
It's so crazy though, because like I've never, ever clicked on an ad, not once.
Right.
Who does?
Well, I got to say that back in the day, whenever Punch the Monkey was actually an ad, I would play the game because I didn't know what was going on. I was like 10. I just saw a monkey and I'm like, I'm going to punch it.
But still, I mean, I just, but see, that's the case. That just takes the steam right out of Google's, you know, argument. If it's
So Google's argument would be that they are better quantifying for the companies that they're advertising for the efficacy of their ads.
Right.
They can say these people are genuinely interested because they click through, and we're tying the efficacy of your ad campaign to what you're paying for it.
Yeah, but one click must be really expensive.
In some cases, it is. If you are advertising for mesothelioma, it's like $10, $30, something like that. Yeah.
Right.
Mm. Wow.
Very interesting. Yeah. So our next topic is not at all in the ad realm. It's with Apple, one of many that we have today with Apple, and one of Apple's new hires. Very interesting. They hired somebody from the Navy, and also from the National Security Agency. He worked at both places to be their global security head. I don't know about you guys, but I don't think Apple has that big of security problems that they need somebody from the NSA to head up their security department. Do you guys think that this is a smart move? Are they preparing for something in the future? Or are they just saying, hey, if we can get them, we'll get them, and we'll use them however we can?
Yeah, I think that's what they're saying. I mean, how much can one guy on your payroll cost if you're Apple?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, you can pay for the best.
Unless that guy's Steve Jobs.
What does Steve Jobs make?
A dollar.
Yeah, I mean, is he stock compensated?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, there's some controversy about that recently in the news, about these CEOs taking a dollar and not paying any income tax for the year.
Oh.
And then there's some guy that, like, who makes, like, you know, all of, like, $30,000 or $40,000 a year. He, like, didn't claim a couple thousand dollars, and he's, like, going to jail for, like, you know, 10 years.
Yeah, well, that's always been one of Warren Buffett's arguments, because he makes, I don't know, $100,000 or something like that as CEO of Berkshire Hathaway, and he has often pointed out that he pays a smaller percentage of his income in income tax than his secretary does.
Yeah.
Because he's basically, what he pays is capital gains.
Yeah.
And his secretary is paying income tax rates.
Right. Yeah. Anyway, sorry, I didn't mean to distract.
No, that's perfectly fine. I'm just still, I think this is a good hire. You know, obviously the dude knows his stuff if he worked at the NSA. I just wonder, whenever I first saw this, I thought, wow, they really went to the top of the line, like the best guy out there, and they got him to come to Apple.
Yeah, but the best guy in the NSA or Navy is making less than $200,000 a year.
Very true.
Right. He's a GS-15 or maybe SES, which is capped to, you know, something less than $200,000 a year. And for the chief security guy at Apple, which is now, what, the second biggest market cap in the country?
Right.
That is not a very large pay scale to beat.
Yeah, they can give him a couple extra bucks and lure him away.
Yeah, so, you know, it's win-win for him and for Apple to get, you know, something that we're talking about on this podcast.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, what did you think about, I mean, have you read his book, Geekonomics?
No, I don't read books.
You don't even read it?
I have not.
I hadn't even really, I've heard of this book, but hadn't really given it much thought. I thought what was interesting about this is his concept about software, and it being sort of like, you know, a public nuisance if it's buggy. It costs money to fix.
He calls them crash test dummies.
Yeah, you know, I think this, and they equate, they say his book to Ralph Nader's Unsafe at Any Speed, in that, you know, we're doing the beta testing.
Right, we're doing the job of the software testers.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with that a lot. You know, one thing you hear a lot about is responsible disclosure. The Google researcher, you know, tries to get Microsoft to fix a bug. They don't, so he tells everyone about it.
Right.
And a lot of people respond to that as if the Google researcher and all of us have some responsibility to the original software vendor to, you know, beat on them until they fix the bugs. And I don't really agree with that. They're the ones producing buggy software, and I don't really see it as the user community's or the researcher's responsibility to handhold them through the process of fixing their defective product.
Yeah.
Right. Somewhere along the line, that paradigm shifted where they thought, hey, we can get away with shipping stuff fast and letting the people figure it out. When did that happen? What?
Well, but see, the thing is, though, I think they're, I'd argue from the other side a bit. I do think that there's, you know, there's some responsibility that they have to fix their bugs. But no system, even those outside of software, are foolproof. Take, for instance, the U.S. Postal Service. I could send a mail bomb through their system, and they probably may or may not be able to detect it. But the harm that I've caused by misusing their system that has this hole, is that the Postal Service's responsibility?
No, I do not at all abdicate taking advantage of the holes. I'm referring to the process of announcing the holes or bringing them to public knowledge. Right, like you can say on this podcast that you can send a mail bomb through the Postal Service.
Right.
Right. I don't think you're a bad person for saying that.
Right. Okay, right. I see what you're saying. Yes.
Right. It's the guy who actually exploits it, who sends a bomb through the Postal Service, or who uses a bug to blow up a nuclear reactor. Those people are evil, and they deserve our condemnation. But I don't think that a researcher is a bad person for saying that this hole exists, especially after they've, you know, made some effort to notify the vendor and the vendor hasn't responded.
Right. No, I agree with that.
And at a more, the more root cause of, or root point of this, the researcher shouldn't even have to say that. You know, the company should have went through proper testing so that there aren't easily findable bugs. I mean, like you said, there's always going to be bugs. Nothing's foolproof. But companies nowadays are making us be the beta testers, like this article says. They're not properly testing. They don't hire enough testers. They're not running it through its paces. They just want to get something out there so they can make money on it or so they can beat other people to markets. Whatever the case may be, they just want to put stuff out there fast.
Well, but see, I think that's the point that I disagree with, that they're not doing enough testing, that they're not doing their job. I mean, I think that it's proven that Microsoft's products through the last 30 so years have brought tremendous value to the world and sped up productivity of most businesses magnitudes to the point that, you know, we're able to have a gross domestic product that we do now, you know, that's magnitudes greater than it was years ago, and for no other reason than we've introduced computers to assist humans in doing their job.
Right.
So I don't think that they're not doing their job. I think that the value that's brought by the product is greater than the detriment that the bugs introduce. I mean, in some cases, and not only is that true, the pace at which technology moves almost makes a lot of this moot. So like, yeah, if I took Windows 3.1 and went Trumpet Windsock and threw it on the internet right now, it probably would have so many holes in it that it would turn into this, like, you know, hacker's haven. But we don't use it anymore because it's technologically infeasible.
Yeah, I think I agree with everything you say. It's just when I hear people speaking as if everyone has an affirmative responsibility to work through a vendor when they discover a problem I have a problem with that.
Yeah.
That position.
And hopefully this hire for Apple will, you know, make them put out better products than they already do. You know, this guy obviously feels that there are problems in the process, and maybe it's going to be his job to fix it and make sure that their products are more secure. We can only hope.
Yeah.
But moving on to another Apple story, it looks like they filed a patent to put a touchscreen on their mice. Do you guys ever see this being used? If you had a touchscreen where the palm of your hand normally sits on a mouse?
I've seen how small screens can be useful. People playing a game have their Twitter feed or their chat feed or something up like that up on a small screen. I'm not sure that needs to be the same thing that I'm manipulating as a touchpad.
Yeah, it seems the picture in the patent is the Apple Magic Mouse, which doesn't have real buttons. They're touch buttons. And so they have the left button, the right button, but where your palm would normally sit, they picture the number pad, as you would normally have on a keyboard on the far right side, the numbers and the enter key and the plus sign. So they're looking to put some sort of changeable screen on a mouse. Ryan, do you see a use for touchscreens on mice?
I really don't. I'm still not completely sold on touchscreens as the best input technology known to man now. I still think that, you know, this, I really do think that the reason the manufacturers have been, you know, basically vacating the electromechanical market is because it saves them money. Electromechanics wear out. They're physical parts. They require a lot of engineer. They require two engineers and, you know, a mechanical engineer and electrical engineer. It's just they're expensive to manufacture and design, and they're a common point of failure. And I don't think that the touch interface is better than electromechanical.
It's definitely not for a numeric keypad.
Yeah.
Yeah, really. That's,
I mean, I would like to see, you know, maybe we probably won't be able to draw these comparisons for a while until there's been people that have been brought up on touch technology that have like learned to type super fast on touch. Now, I mean, I know we've had this argument about BlackBerry versus
on-screen keyboards versus physical keyboards.
Yeah, you know, yeah. But like, let's take, for example, a completely touch-based keyboard for a computer, like a large format keyboard that's touch-based. Do you think that even if somebody was trained on that from ground up, that they could beat the best typists today on a good old IBM M? I mean, those old M keyboards are just like you can type so fast on them.
I would argue yes, they could beat them. just for the mere fact that you have that millisecond of down press and that millisecond of up press for each key that you don't have on touch. That's why I'm so fast on my iPhone compared to a Palm Trio that I had before. I'm not pressing anything. There's no time to hit a key. I mean, I don't know. We have yet to see because there aren't really touch full-size keyboards yet.
Yeah.
But we have another Apple article here, and this one is actually kind of funny. So Apple was giving out a large sum of money to the person who downloaded the 10 billionth app from the App Store. And a lady in the UK, I believe it was Kent, UK.
Is it part of Great Britain?
I believe it's England.
It's England. Okay. Just checking.
But she, or it might have even been one of her daughters. I believe it was her daughter buying a game. It was a paper toss or paper throw. It was a paper game. I forget the exact name of it. But she got a call from an Apple exec, you know, hey, you've just won $10,000. You know, give us your information to claim it. She's like, haha, funny, hang up.
Yeah, I would have totally done the same thing.
I think everybody would have. Because really, how many calls do you get like that every day? And her kids were, you know, after they came up and her mom said something about it, their kids are like, yeah, Apple was totally giving out money. You could have just lost us $10,000. They were mad. But luckily, 4 hours later, the Apple exec called back and she's like, oh, I'm sorry.
If you want to give me $10,000, send me a FedEx.
Yeah, do something that spammers and ad agencies don't do.
Yeah.
But I just thought that was funny that somebody almost lost out on $10,000, a legitimate $10,000 from Apple.
And she probably said, what's a dollar?
Yeah. we use pounds.
Yeah, it's like the Nigerian spammers telling me that I won 143 million pounds, right?
Right. What is that? So our next article kind of goes along with the article we had earlier from Google with the keep your opt-outs, and that is Mozilla is proposing a similar thing, but to be built in to the browser that this header. And I think we pretty much covered this. You know, I should have probably brought this up at the same time we talked about the earlier extension. But let me just ask one question about this article. Do you think this is good to be built into a browser? Good for users / good for companies who have to make money from this? Because right now, ad blocking, not built in, totally optional.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. We haven't seen ad blocking built into any browser.
Right.
And I'm guessing that's an intentional decision that they don't want to be the browser that blocks the revenue source for the sites.
Right. But now Mozilla is proposing putting this in the browser.
I could see them. I mean, Google would definitely, it'd be surprising for them to build it in, like to build, you know, since they are an ad company, as we've stated.
Right.
But for Mozilla, they don't have any allegiance to any advertisers or even websites for that matter.
Where does Mozilla's money come from anymore? They actually have a huge budget, and I don't remember where their money comes from.
They have donate buttons on their site, so people can donate. But
they have an enormous budget.
Yeah,
I saw some figures recently, and it was shocking. So I think they have somebody backing them, and I don't remember who.
Yeah, I have no clue.
Yeah, I'm not really that. I haven't used Mozilla in a long time. Firefox in a while. I mean, I have it on my computer. I actually only use it for Chatzilla, which is an IRC client.
Wow, IRC still exists?
Yeah. Well, there's a group. There's a group of professional audio guys that only. That's how they have a Sunday chat. There's a forum, but then on Sundays they have a chat. In the
wow, you would think that would be like the best sounding Skype call or something.
Yeah, really. The best special effects and crystal clear voices. But no, they use text.
Yes, IRC.
So while we're talking about extensions and things being built into the browser, this article from the BBC talks about an extension which will let you put expiration dates on your images that you upload to the internet. The argument that they gave, you don't want compromising pictures of you that you post to Facebook to be around 10 years from now whenever you might be a CEO of a company. So they're saying that with this extension, this new software, you could put an expiration date on your pictures so they're up there. You can only view the pictures if you have this extension, and they become disabled, inaccessible after a certain date. Good or bad expiration dates on pictures?
BS.
BS? What do you think? You don't think it's going to work?
No, it won't work. I mean, are they going to get rid of print screen or what?
Uh-huh.
I mean, for things like high-def video, you have things like HDCP where you have the protected path to the display and all that garbage. But for a graphic and a web browser, they can take a screen capture. You can't count on this serving its purpose.
Yeah.
And if you can't count on it, it's worthless.
Right. What do you think it...
Well, I mean, this is essentially DRM.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is.
I mean, it's DRM with no hardware support for the DRM.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's I mean, this was one of the big what they trumpeted when the Trusted Computing Alliance platform came out, is that, you know, all documents could have an expiration date, you know, and you could say, here's how long you can use the document, and you can read it, but you can't copy from it, and, you know, if you try to, like, you know, do anything to it, it'll basically self-destruct, and, you know, pictures would obviously be in that camp. Unless people fully, like, wrap their arms around DRM in a good way.
In a good way.
Like to hug it, not to you know, crush it.
Oh, I would like to crush DRM.
You mean like Homer with Bart wrapping his hand around his throat.
The loving way.
Why, you little? No, I think unless people, like, do embrace DRM, this is never going to become a reality, like you said. I mean, it has to have built-in. I mean, there are actually a lot of the computers that are made now do have these Trusted Computing Alliance platform chips, the TPM modules.
Right.
And if the software supports it, it'll lock it down. But I don't even at that, like, for a web page, you know,
what can you do?
I mean, when you're watching something that's protected by HDCP and stuff, you know, in Windows 7, you lose Arrow and all that stuff.
Yeah.
That's not going to happen for an image being shown in a web browser.
Right.
I don't think.
Yeah.
And let's take it one step further. You always have your camera phone.
Yeah, that's true too. Even at the point where they disable the hardware screen capture, or,
right?
You know, the software screen capture, you could take a
people still photo have cameras.
Of it. Yeah,
yeah. And if we're talking about naked girlfriend pictures, which seems to be the target market for
pretty
this,
much, yeah.
Then
yeah,
you either trust the person or you don't.
Yeah.
And
I mean, essentially, they could put some sort of, like, Macrovision. Remember Macrovision on VHS? Actually, DVDs have that too.
No, I have no clue what you're talking about.
So, remember
when you were looking for the boobies on HBO and you didn't get it, and it was green and red and swirly?
Oh,
yeah.
Very similar. Yes. Most VCRs made after, like, 1985 had a Macrovision chip in it. So when you played the VCR through another VCR, the other VCR would scramble the picture so that it wouldn't be able to record it itself.
Oh.
Now, DVD players have this built in too, but mainly in the sense that the recording equipment will pay attention to the Macrovision signal. But you know, they could do that. They could put a Macrovision type signal into the picture or to the video on the screen that would disallow, and then obviously cameras, video cameras, everything else have to support the Macrovision technology,
right,
and deny you the ability to take a photo of it.
So we just got to work on having better memories now. So how would you guys like to make $150,000 just by submitting a job application? You don't get the job. You just get $150,000. Good idea?
Sure. What could possibly go wrong?
Well, one hacker did just this. The job application was a document that he had to download to his computer and fill out, and he implanted some malware into that job application, sent it to the company, and it just so happened that the person who opened the application to read through it and consider hiring him was somebody who had credentials with the company, access to their bank account, and this malware grabbed those banking credentials, sent them back to the hacker, and he stole $150,000. I lean between, is this awesome or is this super bad in terms, you know, from the company's point of view?
This is the most, like, pointed attack I've heard of, like, in recent, like, I mean, this guy
Stuxnet.
Yeah.
Okay, other than Stuxnet.
Technically, I don't think we can talk about that. But anyways, I just mean that, you know, this guy had to, like, find out. He knew the company. He had to have some knowledge of what was going on inside, so that, you know, that this would work. I mean, unless, you know, I don't know, maybe he did just send, I was like, oh, I'm going to put this virus in this file, and I'm going to send 100,000 job applications out.
Which could be.
And if I get one, it's just like spam. Yeah. You know, you send out millions of emails, and if you get a couple hits, you make some money.
What if all you do is send the HR guys Firefox stored passwords?
Yeah, that probably would be enough.
Yeah, and I think the article said this targets very small companies, so the HR guy is also the finance guy, is also the weekend janitor,
yeah. Right?
So maybe you get their banking credentials that way.
Yeah. Why the heck isn't Firefox and, I mean, I don't know about Chrome, why aren't they encrypting that stuff? I mean, are they encrypting that stuff? Are they using AES?
I think they can.
I mean,
But if you don't set a master password.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, that's
and like you said, you send it to 100,000, you find somebody who
hasn't.
Right. Well, I mean, take that for example. You send 100,000 of these out. If you have an automated script to do this, it takes you what? A couple minutes. You know, let's just say a couple hours, maybe a day to write the script to do the sending. You send 100,000 of them out. You get one byte. You've made enough money for what normal people make in 2 years. You don't have to work for 2 years. These guys are geniuses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the spammer model with a much higher return.
Exactly.
And some illegalness mixed in.
A little bit. Just
a little bit. But if you're in Nigeria and you have the choice of being a spammer or doing this, then...
That's true.
the illegalness doesn't matter much, right?
So we have two articles coming up talking about net neutrality, and we mentioned this a little bit last week that we had a video to show. So the first article talks about companies who support censoring the internet, and in a way this also goes along with net neutrality. But before we talk about this, I want to play this video. It's about 6 minutes long. This guy does an awesome job of explaining exactly what net neutrality is, and if you never thought about it before, you hear us talk about it almost every week, maybe now you'll have an idea of why we're so mad about this whole thing after you listen to this guy. So go ahead and take a listen to this video. We'll be back in about 6 minutes.
Net neutrality. A lot of people are talking about it, but there seems to be a lot more confusion than understanding. Here's a quick explanation of what it is and why you should care. The internet is a really complicated hunk of technology, but a super simplified picture is that it works like this. At the top is some large internet provider that carries network traffic. These large companies have organizations as customers, places like universities, corporations, and home internet providers. In turn, these outfits supply internet services to individuals. But what we're concerned with here are these big companies at the top. These are sometimes called Tier 1 providers, meaning they provide internet to customers, but they don't need anybody else to provide internet to them. These big companies are often known by what other stuff they do besides providing internet access. Some are cable television companies, some are telephone companies, others are purely in the business of delivering internet service. When you use the internet, let's say you send an email to your mother, it goes from your computer up to one of these so-called backbones, over to whoever provides your mother with service, and then down through the layers to her computer. The providers handle all the traffic equally. It doesn't matter if you're sending mail, playing an online game, using Facebook, or watching movies, the traffic flows freely. The concern here is that there's nothing forcing them to act this way. See, the internet is basically an anarchy. Not the destructive, chaotic kind, but the beneficial, collaborative kind. It's a global symbiosis. Everybody plays, everybody wins. But there's nobody at the top forcing everyone to play nice. And up until recently, it hasn't been a problem. But what if the cable TV company says, hey, we offer online video, but people from other networks can watch the videos. We're basically delivering content for our competition. We should refuse to let this video content pass through our network unless the other providers give us money. Another company says, we're the telephone company, and people are using the net instead of the phone to talk to each other. Maybe we should block or slow down voice chat. Another provider says to the other two, pay us extra money, or we'll slow down your traffic when it passes through our servers. Now, the important thing to remember is that everything I just mentioned is stuff that these providers have actually talked about. As of this recording, they haven't done anything about it, but they have expressed an interest in altering, blocking, or slowing down network traffic that passes through their network, unless somebody gives them money. I said before that the network is symbiotic. The networks deliver traffic for mutual benefit. But the moment a provider starts discriminating their traffic, as soon as they start delivering traffic that benefits them and blocking traffic that does not, they become parasites. That's not hyperbole. They're exploiting an open system to take without giving. Doing so at the Tier 1 level will break one of the fundamental principles of the network, which has been taken for granted from the very beginning. These companies ask, why should I deliver your traffic for free? And the answer is because everyone else delivers your traffic for free. Net neutrality is not a law, it's an idea. It's the idea that all of these providers should simply send and receive traffic without interruption or prejudice. I want to stress that nobody is trying to take away the ability of these providers to make money. If they want to charge extra for video content, they can do what Netflix does, what World of Warcraft does, which is to do business with individuals. If they find that delivering traffic isn't profitable enough, they're always free to raise prices on their customers. But what they're proposing is to alter the flow and behavior of traffic on the network. This would be like a mailman deciding that since he owns the mail truck, he should be able to go through the mail and change or discard any of the mail that he doesn't like. Some people advocate getting the government involved and somehow forcing net neutrality on the providers. Of course, the obvious question is, which government? The network is global, and nobody has the power to make any of these companies do anything with their own hardware unless a law is passed. International governments get along even worse than these companies, and it's possible that having a government in charge of the network is more dangerous to freedom and privacy than a bunch of bickering internet providers. The first solution that might come to mind would be to simply outlaw tampering with traffic at all, but that would make it illegal for these companies to fight spam and other security threats. Actually making a law that's effective and sensible requires way more technical knowledge than the typical politician can muster. It's entirely possible they might turn to industry experts to help them write these laws, but who do you think those experts will be? The ideal solution, or at least the one that would preserve the prosperity and growth we've enjoyed so far, would be for nobody to seize this power, for the benign anarchy to continue. This anarchy has existed for decades, but now the Tier 1 providers can't seem to control themselves, and some people are adamant that we should head them off with government oversight. So we seem to be left with the choice of having control of the network in the hands of companies or governments. Both of these are less optimal than what we have now. Thanks for watching.
All right, so hopefully you guys can all see, you know, why most of us who come on the show are in favor of net neutrality. But let's go back to this one article real quick before we start the discussion on it. The companies who support censoring the internet, in a sense, you know, part of what this net neutrality video is talking about, companies like Nike, NBC, Viacom, there are golf companies, Callaway, Cleveland, almost all major sports companies, football, baseball, basketball, Time Warner, Timberland. I mean, this company's list on a whose site, TechDirt. I mean, it's ridiculous that these companies support censoring the internet. And one of the reasons they give is, you know, if somebody's selling knockoffs, you would like to be able to say, hey, you know, knock them off the internet. Don't let people see the knockoffs because they're hurting our business.
Yeah, nuke their site from orbit.
Exactly. Whereas I say, if somebody can make something better and cheaper, they deserve the money.
Well, yes, but we still want them to respect trademark, copyright, and patents. Otherwise,
I don't even like patents. If somebody else can make something better than you just because you did it first means nothing.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of like research that goes into making the patents. I mean, you know, like I agree that the in terms of software patents, I think there's a lot of controversy. But in terms of like, you know, a steam engine or something, it's like a something you kind of you know, you need to, like, somebody's got to put in the time up front to you know, basically.
Yeah, but I mean, James Watt invented that, and we named the unit of energy after him, or the unit of power after him, so isn't that enough?
Not
if you're a starving inventor.
Well, if you're a starving inventor, why don't you make something people actually want,
like a steam engine?
But that's the whole point. Like, so I'm an inventor, and I invent this process or this machinery, and it does something that brings value to people's lives. But yeah, I sell the machine and I make money. I sell the machine and I make money. But I might have went in the hole for 5 years developing the machinery. So if you don't respect the patent, the next guy can come along and just copy the design. And yeah, he sells a machine and makes some money, and sells a machine and makes some money. And maybe he sells it cheaper because he doesn't have the $5 million loan that he has to pay back for all of his IR&D. So I still think you have to respect patents, but that doesn't give them a right to knock people off the internet because I think it could be misused.
Oh, definitely.
That's, you know.
Yeah, I agree with Ryan. I think there's a good point behind patent protection, trademark protection, copyright protection, all of these. But there's a due process of law that says if somebody infringes your intellectual property, you sue them, you let a judge decide, let a jury decide. Yeah. You don't just say, hey, that guy hurt me, go take him off the internet right now.
Yeah.
And that is one big point, you know, if net neutrality doesn't get put into effect with actual laws, you know, like happened in December, they did pass some things, but, you know, if net neutrality doesn't happen the way it should happen, then people can do things like this. You know, these large companies who own the internet can just say, okay, we're blocking these sites. They're hurting our business.
I guess the argument, and I'm a big net neutrality advocate when it comes to basically using your network for antitrust, essentially. But, I still think there's an argument from the other side that says, okay, fine, like we understand that that shouldn't be allowed, but do we need a law that says that? Do we need more regulation? Can't we just say when the infringement happens, then we take them to court? For instance, if the Department of Justice can prove that Comcast is actually trying to crush Netflix's business by using the means with which Netflix distributes its material for no other reason than to promote the higher cost of video on demand through Comcast, then they'll win the court case and it's moot whether or not the law existed.
I partially agree with that, but I also think, how long will these court cases take? You know, they could take years, and if Netflix business is crushed for years, they go out of business. Like they can't, nobody can handle their business being.
Well, that's what the lawsuit's for, though. If there's a lawsuit and they win the lawsuit, they may get damages paid to them in excess of the profits they would have made because now their business is gone. I think the best argument for net neutrality though is the consumer, because if that happens, let's say that the laws never pass, we don't have a net neutrality law, and we have to wait for the Department of Justice to file suit, antitrust, blah, 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 blah. Takes years and years. Yeah, Netflix gets a settlement, but the problem is the consumer loses because now they don't have the option that they once would have had.
Yeah, that's an extremely good point. And that's probably the one that resonates most with everybody who listens to this show. You know, I'm pretty certain that most people are consumers. Nobody out there owns NBC or Viacom. And if you do, send me an email.
Yeah, down with NBC. Wait a minute.
Wait. If you do, we would like sponsors. So we would like to make money on this.
Didn't you have an NBC connection last week?
NBC? Did I?
Sort of.
Okay.
Oh, that's... Ooh. Good idea. All right, so we have a couple stories in the audio-visual realm, more in the gaming realm. And a bunch of them, almost all of them in our AV section here go together. So we talked last week about Sony suing Geo Hot, you know, George Hotz, for hacking, quote unquote hacking. It wasn't a bad thing he did, but circumventing protection on the PS3 so that you could run your own games. If you were to write a game that played on the PS3, you could do this now because Sony disabled that. Well, Sony won a restraining order, and now George Hotz can't, you know, he basically can't touch a PS3. He can play games, but he can't do any development work with PS3s now. He's done. So Sony came out with a new firmware to disable all the work that GeoHot had done. Within hours, that firmware was hacked. Funny thing about this, though, what people didn't find until just, I believe, yesterday, is that that new firmware had a rootkit in it. Sony put a backdoor in the firmware that allows them remote access to your machines to run arbitrary commands.
Sony has a history of putting rootkits in
audio CDs. Yes, they do, and they did it again with the PlayStation 3. So anybody who downloads the newest firmware, which, by the way, don't download the newest firmware, but if you have 3.56, you have the rootkit where Sony can connect to your PS3 and run commands to do such things as detect homebrew, disable homebrew, they could do anything. They could shut down your PS3 like this. Nobody else does this, really. Have you heard of any other companies doing this sort of rootkitting on home appliances? I mean, I can't think of any either. I mean, this is ridiculous that Sony thinks they have this sort of authority, especially since the DMCA was just loosened a little bit that you could jailbreak your phones. You know, we talked a little bit last week of how is the PS3 different from a phone?
Yeah.
It's a device that you buy.
Has there been any restriction on the manufacturer's ability to use technological measures to prevent rootkitting? I mean, they can say you have the right to do this, but does that in any way stop the manufacturers from trying to stop you technologically?
I have no idea.
Yeah, I think I've always been in favor of, like, you know, it's this sort of like flies in the face of what I said earlier about, you know, patent and copyright protection, but I still think that it's upon the manufacturers to protect their IP. Like, they don't just get a free license, like, you know.
Through technological means?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, and if there's a way to, if they want to protect their IP, they have every right to.
There's like some old story of either a cable or satellite operator remotely frying the boxes of people who were stealing their service.
Yeah, that's not even an old wives' tale. That actually happened.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it was old C-band satellites that happened. Or,
ooh.
Yeah.
One of them, yeah.
So let me just get this straight. What are you saying you agree with? Do you agree with this rootkitting? Or do you just agree with them putting out patches to disable homebrew and the stuff they consider bad?
For the record, I'd like everyone at home to know when Kevin said the words, "Do you agree with this rootkitting?" He looked at me with eyes such that if I would have said yes at that moment, he would have jumped over the table and slashed my throat.
No, I just wanted to make certain because I was slightly confused as to where you stood on this by your last answer. So I just want to know for certain what of this do you agree with?
Well, There's a couple points. Like, one, I think if you buy hardware, you own the hardware. It's your property now. So they have. I think there is a fine line of them putting something on the device that subverts your privacy, subverts your actions, and other things of that nature. I do think that there's an explicit separation between the software and the hardware, and there always should be. That said, I don't know that. Like, if they want to put something on there to protect or keep you from getting into the software, then I think that they're allowed to do that. It's no different than encryption. I mean, they could just, you know, they could use AES encryption on it or something, or, you know, and then you'd never get in.
Or all the things Apple does to try to detect people jailbreaking their phones. Right. Yeah. I mean, it's the same kind of thing, some fingerprinting or something. Well, I think there's sort of I hearken back to the golden days, right, where it was a battle of wits between the company's engineers and the hackers, right, and may the best man win.
Mm-hmm.
And once you know, if you're going that way, that's fine. You have a battle of wits, and it's noble and everything. Then once you throw the DMCA or something into it so that the company has both the engineering and the law on their side, it's no fun anymore.
Right.
Yeah.
Especially for the guy, the hacker guy.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the DCMA, that in and of itself was complete crap.
Agreed. So in lieu of all this rootkitting and jailbreaking for the PS3, do either of you guys own a PS3?
No.
Do either of you guys own any gaming system like a Wii, PS3, PS2, anything like that?
No. I have a GameCube.
Okay, a GameCube.
And some emulators.
So let's just take a GameCube, for example. Any set-top box, you know, if anybody had an NES in the past or whatever. How would you feel if you had a set-top gaming box, you bought a game, and you had to come home and in order to play that game, type in a serial key a la the computer? Sorry, not on the computer, but like you would with a computer game.
So you have to look up the battleship and the fifth word underneath it on page 83 of the manual?
Exactly. I mean, how would you feel serial keys on consoles? We have it on computer. How would you feel on consoles?
I don't like it on computers, so I don't see why I would like it on a console.
I agree with that. But.
Well, I mean, no one likes it, but it's like, if that's what they need to do to protect their game, then, I mean, I'm not going to... I don't believe in pirating entire works, you know, for the use, for other than what I would consider fair use. I think fair use is now too restrictive in the sense that they don't allow a lot of fair use. I think if you want to copy a game and try it for a couple days, you should be allowed to do that. But I don't think that you should be allowed to, you know, and I think the way that would work with a serial number is that if they somehow detected that only one serial number was allowed on the internet at any one time, your friend would use a serial number and say, hey, can I borrow this game for a couple days to play it? and you can borrow the game. But like, there's a lot of copyright law out there on both CDs and games and software that says that you are not allowed to even give the software to someone else. The license is for you and you only, and that's it. And when you die or when you stop using the software, no one else can use it. And I think that is wrong.
Yeah, which a lot of people have a problem with because they always compare it to books. You can loan books to anybody, but you can't computer software?
Yeah, right. In the old days, I think it was like the Borland software products and stuff had a license that explicitly likened it to a book that right. You could run it on any one computer at a time. You could loan it to someone as long as only one of you was running it at a time,
right.
That kind of thing. And you don't see that anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I don't play very many games on my PS3, but I would be pretty mad if I had to enter in a serial number using a stupid remote controller with two sticks.
Up, down, down, left, right, BA, start.
Yep.
Bam!
Contra.
The Konami code. So, talking about all this stuff with Sony and them suing people, they also sent a takedown notice to GitHub. If you don't know what GitHub is, it's an online repository that allows you to do version control. If you've ever used Subversion or CVS or, you know, ClearCase in enterprises, anything that lets you do version control, GitHub is an open source central repository on the internet for doing this. And a lot of people use that to store their programming that they're doing. And Sony found projects such as PS3 Keys, PS3 Tools, PS3 Utils, LV2 Patcher, PS Groove. So obviously all of the software that these people were using to break the PS3 was stored on GitHub with clear names that let you know what they were doing. And Sony sent some takedown notices, and it looks like GitHub complied. So I don't really want to talk about this very much other than to say these guys are idiots for naming their stuff in a way that Sony can just look at it and say, yeah, we're going to take that down.
Can you get around it, or is it something like you... Sony could search for a hexadecimal string.
Ooh, I don't know if you can do that. I mean, I assume... I don't know how permissions work on GitHub. I don't use GitHub, so I couldn't tell you. But it's just interesting that they found these. So there mustn't be very strong security mechanisms on these repositories, because if they can find them, you know, they're obviously out there viewable to anybody.
I was thinking that was sort of the purpose of GitHub, was public repositories.
Right.
But I don't really know what...
Well,
the other
part of it might be that while the files might be secure, they may be indexed and searchable.
Right, you can see the names, you can see maybe what the files are, you just can't read the files.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Sony's going all out. They do not want people modifying their PS3s.
Well, I think they were bit pretty hard by the mod chips back in the PS1 days. I mean, I think that's why Sony is so... And I think they're probably their motion picture and audio business is probably just reeling over, you know, mainly piracy in Asia. And also, you know, I'd say more so the movie piracy in Asia and probably music piracy in the United States. And
right. Well, I mean, look at the Wii. You know, my Wii is modded that I can take any games that I buy, back them up to my hard drive, an external hard drive that I have connected to my Wii, so I never need to put my DVDs in again. Mm-hmm. I can just play every game that I own from a hard drive. You know, this is something that Sony would disable. Nintendo doesn't seem to care, because no updates that I have downloaded have made my stuff not work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I think Ryan's raising a good point that the entertainment concerns of Sony affect the corporate culture.
So because they're in multiple businesses...
Right. Plus, their entire industry revolves around, like, media. I mean, because... Sony takes a loss on the PlayStations. I don't think, like, Nintendo may take a little bit of a loss early on, but they really design for, like, affordable hardware. You know, they want to make a profit on both the games, the licensing, but, they are a media company essentially as well, but, they're still kind of like, they're more like Apple in the sense that, like, they're more of a hardware company too.
Yeah, they are very similar to Apple. I never thought of that.
Yeah.
That's interesting. So let's stop talking about Sony and all of this bad stuff, and let's talk about something super, really freaking awesome. And this has been super, really freaking awesome for the past 10 or 15 years when we first heard about this, and that is Duke Nukem Forever.
No way!
Is finally coming out.
No way!
How awesome is this?
Eh.
So, yeah, eh. So for those of you who don't know, after Duke Nukem 3D, the next game...
They may not have been born.
That's true. Yeah. A lot of people might not have ever known this game existed. But the sequel was going to be a game called Duke Nukem Forever, and forever seemed to be the amount of time we had to wait for it to come out, because it never came out.
It's quite ironic.
Yeah, I know, really? Problem being that the company who was making it They made a game. It worked. Everything was awesome. And then some new hardware came out or some new technologies came out. They're like, oh, we got to do that in the game. So they redesigned the game to use these new technologies. That took 2 years. And then new hardware came out. Oh, we got to make it do this now. And they kept doing that, redesigning the game every time something new came out. And it just so happened that the game never came out. Well, now a new company took over the IP for Duke Nukem Forever, and they are releasing it. There is a set date now.
And it will support my new hover platform-equipped holographic display, right?
Yes.
Good. I've been waiting for something to do that.
So all you have to do is wait until May 3rd, because May 3rd is when Duke Nukem Forever hits the stores.
May 3rd of...
2011.
Wow.
This year.
Anybody taking bets on whether this will actually happen?
I thought it was really funny. On another site, I saw somebody took a picture of them holding their pre-order receipt from 10 or 15 years ago.
Oh, I saw that.
Yeah. Where they actually pre-ordered the original Duke Nukem Forever. He was going to take it back into GameStop and be like, do you guys still honor this?
Was that receipt in Sanskrit or Aramaic?
It was Aramaic.
Okay, good.
I think, well, actually, wasn't the receipt like one of the companies that went belly up? They're like, oh, I wonder if...
It was. It was one of the game companies that isn't around anymore.
Yeah, like EB or something.
Something
right?
like that, yeah.
Isn't EB owned by GameStop?
I don't know. It's been so long since I've been in a game store, I couldn't tell you.
Yeah.
But anyways, we're going to take a little break now for one of our sponsors. We have a sponsor, Internet Service Provider, is sponsoring our show, Egypternet. Do you like Twitter? We know you don't. Do you enjoy updating your Facebook status? Who has time for that? And posting videos on YouTube? Well, that'll get you shot. If you're like every other oppressive politician, we know you want an Internet Service Provider dedicated to your fundamental human rights, such as the denial of free speech, death to dissidents, and not being Rickrolled. At Egypternet, when people use the internet to make the world a better place, we shut it off. Egypternet. Hey, we're your only choice. So hopefully, you know, all of you now want to switch your internet service providers to Egypternet.
Mm. So. And if you don't, you're still in denial.
That's a joke on multiple levels. So anyways, enough talking about Egypt. We beat that horse dead at the beginning of the show. So let's move on to some social networking stories that we have. The first one, have either of you ever used a dating site called plentyoffish.com?
No.
It hasn't been around for that long, so I guess if you've been in relationships for the past couple of years, you probably haven't. But it's a free dating site, which is why a lot of people are attracted to it. And it is the most insecure site ever. Just by the way, I want to point that out. They send you your password in plain text every week. In an email.
Every week?
Yeah. Every week they say, hey, you have new matches, and by the way, your password is, and they put it in plain text in the email.
It's very helpful.
It is. I find myself needing that all the time.
Well, you could just change it every week.
Well, now you should change it, because somebody hacked Plenty of Fish because they are so insecure, and they can now, or at the time that they hacked it, got access to every user account and their password. If you have an account on that site, you would have noticed in the past couple days you were forced to change your password. But I changed my password. I have an account on the site. I changed my password to the same thing that it was, and it let me do it. So that just goes to show how bad this site really is.
They'll never guess that.
They will never guess it.
Oh, he wouldn't have changed it to the same thing. What kind of idiot? What?
Who uses that on their luggage? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. But what I find funny is that, have you guys seen the commercials for this site?
No, I have a TiVo.
There are television commercials on big channels, ESPN and major networks. I find them mostly during sporting events for Plenty of Fish, like real awesome production quality commercials. You would think that they would be at least as nice looking and as good as eHarmony or the other sites that advertise that have good websites, but these guys are crap. Like, it's clear that some dude in his basement wrote this site and finally made some money off of ad revenue and said, I'm buying a commercial. And now that they have people looking at their site, they get hacked. But go ahead. It looked like you had something to say. No.
I was just going to say, did they use like the stock footage of the aquarium or what for Plenty of Fish?
It's bad. I mean, I need to delete my account. It's that bad.
You know, so did you enroll for this deliberately, or did they just enroll everyone in the country?
Well, we don't live in Australia.
Okay.
So yes, I did deliberately make myself an account on this site. Oh, Australia, what are you thinking? So our next story, while we're talking about hacking Facebook, and not just Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg's Facebook got hacked. And some dude decided
Wait. There's two Facebooks?
Yes. It's kind of like the internet and internet too.
Oh.
I thought Google.
Yes. The Googles.
Sorry.
How do I get to the internet? I don't have my AOL floppy. But yeah, so no, the same Facebook that everybody uses.
So the one he owns.
Yes, Mark Zuckerberg's profile page. His account. His
profile page.
His account, his username and password.
I see.
Somebody hacked in and started posting. Well, let me just read what this person posted on his account. Let the hacking begin. If Facebook needs money instead of going to the banks, why doesn't Facebook let its users invest in Facebook in a social way? Why not transform Facebook into a social business the way the Nobel Prize winner Muhammad Yunus described it? What do you think? Hashtag HackerCup2011. So obviously this guy was just trying to stir up some trouble. He did put a link in his comment that he posted on Mark Zuckerberg's page. I didn't click the link, obviously, because I don't want all my stuff stolen. But what do you guys think about this? That the person who owns it got their stuff hacked.
Do we have an explanation yet for how this happened?
Not that I'm aware of.
I haven't seen anything either.
Yeah. I've been looking, too, because I'm interested to know.
I'm pretty sure he had an account on plentyofish.com.
Oh, and that's... Oh,
he used the same
username
and
password.
Yeah. Yeah, lots of people do that.
But this is just another thing in a long line of bad things for Facebook. And it's more funny than making you paranoid, because it's Mark Zuckerberg. He owns the thing. He invented it. And now he gets hacked. But it turns out now that anyone else who uses Facebook, anything you post can be brought up in the court of law. And I'm not just talking about public things. If you have your profile set to public or things that you post and let everybody see, I'm talking private things that you have permission set on that only certain people can view. Now the courts are setting precedent that they're allowing people in certain cases to go into somebody's Facebook page, pull down anything that's private that they think can help their case, and use it in the court of law. What do you guys think of that?
It's pretty crazy. I saw a couple of the examples they gave. It was like some lady she was depressed or something or other, and they're like, oh, well, you were posting your status on Facebook, or not Facebook, MySpace, that you were happy. So like,
You use a smiley face.
So like, you mustn't have been sad. It's interesting. I watched a video about why not to talk to the police. It was just, I don't know, somebody linked to it on Reddit, and I was like, okay, I'll watch it. And it was this defense lawyer, and he talked about basically why you should never talk to the police if you're even if you're not suspected of a crime. But like, he just gives all the reasons you should never talk to the police. And it's actually pretty insane, because there's examples of them where they just set you up for a lie. Like, it has nothing to do with what they're convicting or trying to convict you for. But if they just set you up for a lie, then you have no credibility, and then the jury won't believe you. And that's true if you're a witness, too.
Yeah, that's a common tactic for lawyers.
Right. So as soon as credibility is gone, then it's just that. And like, there's people that have gone to the prison over this, simple little things. But
yeah, very true. Do you use Facebook, Matt?
Yes, I do. I guess I don't have a problem per se with the fact that facts you might think are private may end up in a court of law. Obviously, in a lot of divorces, facts that would be private might end up in a court of law. If you're on disability, things you do that you think are in private may end up in a court of law. So I don't find that inherently offensive. But some of the things, like Ryan mentioned, I saw the same thing about somebody saying they're happy on Facebook, and this is used as evidence of happiness. That's just absurd on a logical basis. That doesn't make sense. You can't count on people to accurately represent their emotional state. It's a normal human thing to, act like you're cheerful and put on a strong face, a happy face, and not try to drag people down with your problems, that you can't use that as evidence of true happiness.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I don't have so much of a problem with the courts getting this information, because like you said, in other situations not internet related, that stuff comes out. But in the case where lawyers can take that and twist it, and that's what's going to happen. Just like with net neutrality, people are going to abuse stuff. Exact same thing here. The lawyers can abuse it. So there are a couple things that we talked about previously. This has happened since last May with Facebook, the instant personalization. It used to just be a pilot program that only, you know, not everybody had it, but it was one of those things turned on by default that when you go to other pages, non-Facebook, you would see a Facebook bar. It would tell you you're logged in. It would show you things that your friends are doing. You know, generally things we don't want to happen, bad things, taking your information. Well, it's now public. It's going into effect. And it's one of those things, you know, I just wanted to bring up this story to remind people to go into your account settings and uncheck the instant personalization so that...
Kevin just doesn't want you sharing information about him. That's all it's really about.
Well, that's the thing that most people probably don't realize is that you can uncheck it for yourself so you're not sharing information about your friends. But if they also don't do it, they're sharing information about you.
Unless you go ahead and turn off all the things that you can share with your friends.
Very true.
Via other applications.
Yeah.
That's a separate setting.
You could just go into your permissions and disable everybody from looking at everything.
Yeah, last night I just realized that basically none of my applications I need. the Facebook applications I don't care about anymore. I don't play any games on there. And I just went through the application settings and cleaned house.
Most of them are junk.
Yes.
Like, I use one that I'm aware of, and that's to link my Twitter account to my Facebook page so I don't have to do multiple updates.
Yeah, I use stuff like that, you know, the Twitter feed to syndicate my blog posts, things
right.
like that. But I went through and got rid of the, you know, are you smarter than a zucchini quiz and all that stuff.
Unfortunately, I was not. So. Yeah. But along that same line, some people might have actually seen ads on the right-hand pane where the sponsored stories, what Facebook calls them, and you might have seen people you know show up in those ads. Well, this is a new thing that whenever you go to websites and you click like, whenever other websites, not Facebook websites, have the like button and you click it, you could show up in ads on Facebook. The example that this article from Adage gives, or is it Ad Age? I guess Advertising Age. I call Adage. Jessica Gronsky, second time today at Starbucks with Philip Zagoras. And it's an ad for Starbucks on Facebook. And just because you used Facebook Places and you checked in and you clicked like on the Starbucks page, they're using your likeness to make money for them.
If Facebook thinks that the fact that I went somewhere or that I like something is going to encourage others to buy that product, they are sorely mistaken.
There are stupid people out there. I mean, because if you think about...
Wait a minute, what are you saying?
I'm saying I'm stupid. No, well, think of it this way. People use products because their friends use it. That's usually the best way that people get introduced to things. If your friend says, hey, I bought this thing and it's useful, you're probably more likely to buy it than if you just saw an ad on TV or heard something on the radio. So they're taking advantage of that.
Yeah, my manager said he might listen to the Sloncast this week.
See? That's exactly it. And Facebook is now taking advantage of that. Do you guys have a problem with this? If you checked in at Starbucks, your face showing up on Facebook to other people to sell Starbucks.
And
not getting a cut.
Well, yeah. Like, I think this should work one of two ways. Like, at least, you know, if I have a web presence, you know, I can get Google AdWords and, like, make money from Google AdWords. And I think there should be a way that, you know, we as people can sell our character if they want to use it. I think what the argument would be is your character is worth no money to us. We won't pay for it. This is sort of like the, you know, like the people that download music, they say, oh, well, I would never have bought it, so I haven't hurt you monetarily.
Right.
So like they may say, well, no one will ever pay for your web presence, so we're just going to steal it.
That is true.
So I don't know. I don't know if I really have that much of a problem with it, but I think there should be a way to disable it. If they did that, I'd be happy.
Yeah. I mean, for me personally, I doubt that I would ever show up in a Facebook ad because I don't use Facebook Places to check into places and I don't click the like button ever on anything. So that seems to be the only two ways that you get into these ads. So I don't know. Do you do either of those things, Matt?
No, I don't. But I can see them, you know, scanning your status updates or something for references to companies. That wouldn't surprise me even if they're not doing it yet.
So just like today, I made a post about Starbucks. It had the word Starbucks in it. So now I'm going to show up in a Starbucks ad.
Yeah, or you're talking about Battlestar Galactica and mentioned Starbucks. And,
you know. Oh, boy. Yeah. Well, our last article about Facebook, Ryan and I both submitted it, but I'll let Ryan take it.
Yeah, so we talked a while back about that tool that somebody had made for Firefox that would allow you to steal login information for
Firesheep.
Firesheep, yes. And one of the obvious targets is Facebook. If you're on an open network that's unencrypted, somebody can basically steal your session cookies and log in to Facebook as you. So one way to prevent this is by using HTTPS. And it's nice now that Facebook has enabled HTTPS login to protect your account. And this should disable a FireSheep attack.
It very much
for
should.
Facebook.
For Facebook. Yeah, so previously, you know, we had said use the EFF's HTTPS Anywhere extension, and that would, you know, force Facebook to be HTTPS. But now, if you go into your account settings, there is, or there will be, because they roll out things over a couple days, maybe
a couple
weeks.
Yeah, I still haven't got the, like, new Facebook messaging yet.
Yeah, I have it. I can invite you.
Oh, you can invite me?
Yeah, somehow I got an invite, like, 4 weeks ago.
Oh, okay, cool.
Which is actually a month. So anyways, yeah, so if you don't have the checkbox for enabling HTTPS or secure authentication, you will soon. Keep checking. They call it secure browsing will be the checkbox on Facebook. But did you want to talk about the other thing in this article?
No, that's all I really... I didn't even... Honestly, didn't notice there was anything else in the article.
So the other thing the article talked about, which I thought was pretty cool, last week we talked about CAPTCHAs and how they suck. Well, Facebook is implementing a new version of a CAPTCHA, which is in order to log into a system, instead of typing in a scrambled word, they show you a couple pictures of people that you know, and you have to say, who is this? And it matches them with the tags of the photos, and supposedly, machines are not good at this.
Right.
Matt, what do you think?
Yeah, I'm not very good at this either, because half of my friends have replaced their profile picture with a picture of their infant.
I hate that.
Yes. Yeah, so...
Or some, like, really artsy photo of them.
Yeah, so trying to tell 20 friends apart based on a 16 by 16 pixel image of their infant,
right.
I'm not very good at. The computer's probably better.
Or most people around here now that have the terrible towel as their Facebook picture.
Yes.
There are downsides to this. It's a novel approach. Well, somewhat novel. It's a bit like the cat-dog thing that Microsoft came up with.
Right.
What was it called? HIP? I think it was called HIP.
Oh,
Human something.
I have no clue.
I think it was HIP. But anyway, I think it's novel. You know, we talked before about people sending passwords in a clear and, you know, all these different ways to hack websites. And I think that we need new approaches to security that are, you know, they're better suited to human interaction, less likely to be hacked, and you know, don't require memorization of arbitrary long length passwords.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And actually, Matt, before you brought up your point, I thought this was a really good idea. But then you said what you said, and I thought, you know, I do have a lot of friends who are tagged in photos that they're not in, or the photos are of their kids or something else. So now I'm torn. You know, I thought this was a good idea, but now I'm not so sure. But either way, at least Facebook is trying to do something good, unlike all the other stuff that they do. So now let's move into our last section of the day. We have a bunch of stories in the mobile realm. And this first one I kind of thought was funny. It's a video. The video is all words, so I'll have to read it to you as I play it. But it's a Motorola taking a jab at Apple's 1984 ad campaign that they ran in 1984. So let's play this video, and I will read to you what it says. 2011. The years count down into the 90s, and we finally arrive at 1984. 2011 looks a lot like 1984. One authority. One design. One way to work. It's time for more choices. More speed, dual-core processor, 1080p video playback. 3G upgradable to 4G. More flexibility. Android 3.0 Honeycomb and Flash. 5 megapixel rear camera and front camera. More freedom. It's time to explore. It's time to live a free life. Motorola. And you can't see it, but Ryan has his hands up in the air. Like the original ad. But, basically, the video was just a picture of a spinning Mars-looking planet with words floating around it. So
it's interesting. I mean, it is like a flashback to, like, you know, the old IBM days.
Yeah, and it's funny how, you know, they're right. It kind of looks exactly like it did in 1984, at least the way they're making fun of Apple, you know, that it's still one way to do things, and they're saying, hey, Android does things differently. Why don't you come take a look at us? Matt, have you had any hands-on with Android devices that...
Very little.
Yeah.
I can't comment a lot on that.
Yeah, I also can't, other than my general just hate for them. And one of those reasons that I hate them is what they're doing now with their OSs. Our next article from ZDNet talks about Google forking Android. So what they found out...
You said that right, folks. Forking.
Forking. F-O-R-K. So what they found out is that their current version of Android, 2.2, 2.3, the 2 dot line, is not good for tablets. It's good for small screens. It's not good for big screens. So they come out with Android 3 Honeycomb, supposed to be better for tablets. But the problem that a lot of people...
Is that the Honeycomb's big philosophy? Yeah.
Yes. That is exactly it. But what the problem is now with developers... Ryan's looking funny.
I feel like I missed out on the...
The Honeycomb cereal. The old ads were Honeycomb's big, yeah. So if you have a version for tablets...
That's it.
Oh, wow.
I really wish I would have found an old ad that I could bring up on YouTube.
That's post-processing, right?
Yeah. We'll do that in post, totally. Don't wait for that. But anyways, Android 3 is significantly different from Android 2. And a lot of people are complaining about this because that means... developers now have to learn different things to program for each one. They have to make different apps for each one. So as far as users are concerned, you know, we as the users of these devices probably don't care at all. It's the developers that care. I personally think this is just more fragmentation in the Android market. We already have carriers doing their own thing, making their own versions of Android OSs, and now we have Google making different versions of Android OSs.
Is this that different from having different versions in the Apple App Store for the iPad and the iPhone iTouch sizes?
And that was one of the arguments that some people say it's not that different. However, you can have one app that works on both. So I found in my iTunes store, I have apps that are both iPhone and iPad, and depending on which device they're on, the interface is different. So it's like a universal app.
Okay, so, and that's actually impossible in Android?
From what I've been reading, yes. Okay. You need separate apps because they're totally different. And, you know, it seems like at least with Apple's, with iOS, you still only have one SDK. Like, the way they're talking with this with Android, everything is separate. Like, if you want to develop for one, you do it this way. If you want to develop for another, you do it another way. So, Ryan, being, you know, doing a lot of software development, what do you think about Google doing this?
Well, I think that there should be a way to overcome this. I mean, if you design two different apps, maybe they can package it into one app and still deliver it via the marketplace. The application just detects which version the operating system is running on. I mean, I shouldn't say I guarantee. I would find it highly unlikely that an Android 2.0 app would not run on an Android 3.0 system. It may not run with all the same features,
and that's the problem that they're
right. But my point is that that's going to be a part of something the developer has to worry about. They have to detect the OS and load the right, you know, libraries or whatever, you know, that they need to load to get it to work.
Yeah, and I would like if there was one SDK that had all the features and it was up to the developer to detect whether that feature was there based on the device and the, you know, what it's running, and then make that in their code instead of having to have two different SDKs, two different development processes, two different apps. You know, from the developer's point of view, I would much like, you know, my earlier version where I have one SDK, I make one app, I have to do some detection, but it's still one app.
I wonder if if iPhone like 1.0 apps like right away, like if you just like they would load on the iPhone 4 and like work with like no modification.
I have no idea.
You know, I bet that that behind the scenes the Apple developers face some of these challenges too when the hardware changes.
Yeah, I wonder if iOS has ever quote unquote forked, you know, from 1 to 2, 2 to 3, 3 to 4.
Yeah.
If those are just complete cutoffs and we just don't realize it.
Yeah.
But keeping up with Google Android, the newest version, 2.3 Gingerbread, has a flaw that leaks some data. And what's funny about this is the previous version, 2.2, had an extremely similar flaw that they were told about, they fixed, but somehow a flaw almost identical showed up in version 2.3. Matt, I know you don't use Android, so you probably don't care that much. I don't use Android. I don't care. Ryan, do you care so much?
Well, I mean, I don't know. I think we make a really big deal out of these different security vulnerabilities and that sort of thing. I think Google's shown best effort in trying to fix the bug. It'll, you know, hopefully they'll come out with a patch and the next OS or some security fix or something like that. This does, I think, demonstrate for really any operating system, mobile operating system, there's probably less of a chance for them to be able to deploy, especially in the Android world, with there's all these different vendors, deploy a fix to all the phones, because it seems like Motorola, HTC, and Samsung and the rest of them have all had like different release schedules of the patches and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you. You know, this does show that Google tries.
Yeah.
You know, they're taking feedback, they're fixing it. But yeah, depending on your device, could be a problem. You might not get an update in, you know, till a month from now. But at least it's a non-root exploit. So if anybody does, you know, do this, they're only getting into the sandbox of the application, so they're not taking over your phone. So don't worry that much if you have an Android device. But at least be happy that Google was trying. But let's move on to something that I don't know if you guys have had trouble with, but I know people who have. Water damage on your cell phones. Something happens, you take it back to the store, they see the stickers that have turned colors, and you don't get a new phone. Has that happened to either of you guys?
It hasn't, no, but I've heard of it happening.
Yeah, I have some friends who are particularly klutzy that have had several phones happen, you know, suffer this fate.
Well, normally, you know, if you've ever talked to those friends and find out what happened, what the company will say, whoever they take it back to, you know, these stickers turn colors, we are not giving you a new device, your problem. Well, Apple now is loosening up a little bit. So one thing that is interesting about the Apple device is that the sticker is inside the headphone jack. I didn't realize this, but if you look inside the headphone jack, you shine a light in there, magnifying glass, the sticker is at the bottom of it. It's metallic in color until it gets wet, and then it turns red like all the other ones. But now they're saying the last line of their liquid contact indicator, or LCI paper, if a customer disputes whether an iPod with an activated LCI has been damaged by liquid contact, and there are no external signs of damage from corrosion, then the iPod may still be eligible for warranty service. So what do you guys think about this? I think it's cool that Apple is kind of taking the first, you know, being the first company to take a step and say, okay, this isn't all telling you broke your phone.
Yeah, I think this is a good thing. I don't think it's very reasonable for a company to create the product, create the means of assessing water damage, and enforce that means all on their own without, you know, any opportunity to challenge by any other, you know, say an expert witness, you know,
right,
somebody else who can dispute the engineering or how meaningful that indicator is. So I don't like the old system. I don't like that they can just declare by fiat that if this is changed color, that for sure meant that you dunked your phone in water. That's not reasonable to me.
Right.
So I'm glad to see this.
Yeah, I'm surprised that, like, you know, they would even put these moisture sensors near open air, because, like, I wouldn't be surprised if, like, a very humid summer in a, you know, within a very cool night could just cause condensation.
That was actually one of the arguments somebody used. They said it was a really cold day and my sensor turned red.
Right.
Yeah, from an engineering standpoint, that's a stupid thing to do. Right,
yeah.
Because you're going to get false positives. But if
right.
your intent is to deny warranty claims, then it's a great thing to do.
Well, right, obviously.
If you're trying to save money. Yeah. Which, I mean, I don't know that... I would like to think that no company wants to do that, but...
here's the point. Like, this is... I don't even know why Apple fights their warranty claims. Because if their hardware and their crap is as good as they say it is, then they should just stand behind it. And if it breaks, it breaks. Like, just replace it. If their failures are really that low, then what what are the, you know, what, how is this going to hurt their bottom line?
Yeah, do the Nordstrom approach or the Costco approach where you stand behind your product, and if someone has a problem with it, you fix it, and yeah, you don't ask too many questions.
Yeah, Walmart's sort of the same way. You can return anything to Walmart. I mean, like,
you don't even have to buy it at Walmart.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I mean, not to be dishonest, but like, I a couple years ago, I got a, you know, the Lord of the Rings for Christmas, and it was, this was actually several years ago when it came out on DVD, and I brought it home, and I hadn't opened it. It had been like months, you know, like it sat, and I opened it, and I went to watch it, and the third disc did not work. Like, it didn't work. Like, I get like 10 minutes into it, and it just stopped, or maybe a second disc, I don't remember. But anyway, it didn't work. I don't remember where I got it, honestly. I think it was a gift. I thought my parents said they bought it at Walmart. I don't remember. I took it back to Walmart. They took it. They're the only way you can return movies. The only way. Like, I tried, you know, going through, like, you know, Warner Brothers, whoever does the distribution. They don't want to have anything to do with you. They won't support their product. So, I mean, I think Apple should just take the lead in consumer advocacy rights and say, you know, hey, we'll fix your stuff no matter what.
And this is what actually struck me about this article, is that they do that if you go to an Apple store. Like, if I had some random thing wrong with my MacBook, I walked into an Apple store and said, this is broke. If they can't fix it, I forget what the time limit is, but in a very short amount of time, bam, new one on the spot. Yeah. They do that for every product of theirs. So I found this kind of weird that the water damage, they were still going on that old way of, oh, we're not going to fix it. Yeah. Because with everything else, they fix it on the spot.
I mean, I guess they have to be careful. If they open the doors up, the floodgates, no pun intended, may open. And, like, they will just have a vast amount of these broken iPods coming back. But you know what? I think the iPod, I love the aspect of the iPod. I still love aspects of it. But it's still one of the worst music players ever made. Like, it, I've had 4 or 5 iPods. They break if you look at them wrong. The hard drive based ones. they're very, very touchy. I have a 5th gen that seems to have held up better than the others. But early on, I mean, those Toshiba hard drives are in them are just crap. But anyway.
Yeah, Apple has pretty high margins. I think they can afford to stand behind it.
Yeah,
you know, there's
I
other
agree.
Companies, you know, REI, L.L. Bean, those companies, you can take back, you know, your 20-year-old, you know, fishing vest or whatever.
Yeah, and they're like, oh, it tore? Okay, here's
yeah.
another one.
So our next article is also talking about an Apple device. Ryan, I believe you submitted this one.
Yeah, actually, there's two articles here. I think they kind of relate to each other. So the first one is from Ars. It's basically about, you know, what happens when these fancy new gadgets die. Like, we've heard about hard drives dying, you lose your data. You can go to one of those data recovery services. They charge like $1 million per gigabyte. You know, so like, if you want your pictures from your grandma's birthday from 5 years ago, like, it's going to cost you an arm and a leg. But so now people are having this problem with iPads, and there's not a lot of resources out there to recover data from, like, transistors, basically. And that's
solid state
memory. That's what's inside the iPad. So this company is now offering data recovery services for your iPad. $1,000 they charge, and they'll recover all the data in your iPad. And I think this is kind of cool, because these portable devices, especially if they're used as primary storage, which they shouldn't be, but if they are being used that way, it's nice to know that for $1,000 I can get all my memories back. That may sound like a lot pricey to somebody else, but in my opinion, it's the equivalent of having your house burned down. If your house burned down and for $1,000 you could have all of your family photos back, I'm sure you would pay it. I mean, obviously, there's probably other methods to protect your data. But one interesting thing about this is that I didn't know is that Apple uses hardware-level encryption on their solid-state devices. So it makes recovering this data particularly challenging. And this, I think this is another example of really unnecessary proprietariness that Apple has put into their system. And I don't know. What do you guys think about that?
Oh, Matt, you look like you had something to say a little earlier.
I was just thinking on the more general topic of data recovery. I think it's great that there's companies working on data recovery from flash media with, you know, all the big solid-state drives now. That's going to be a big deal and a valuable service. I wonder how often it comes up in the context of an iPad, which, like you said, isn't really a primary storage medium. You know,
right.
If you dump your Squirt here on my iPod Touch that's sitting here, you know, and foul the water sensors and break it, then what have I lost? Nothing, because I synced it before I came over here.
Mm-hmm.
And I would imagine most iPads are being used that way. There may be, you know, a few corner cases where somebody has a day's or a week's worth of creative effort on it, and it's nice that there's an avenue for recovering that, but it just doesn't seem like a real big market to me.
Right.
I don't have a lot to say on the internal encryption aspect. I'm not sure why they're doing that. I don't know if it has some benefit in terms of, you know, if somebody steals your iPhone, does that make it harder for them to recover your passwords and stuff?
It's probably that, and it's probably also so hackers or jailbreakers, you know, it's a lot harder for them to get access to your data if it's hardware level encrypted.
Yeah, well, one of these things I support and the other I don't. So So without knowing the motivation, it's hard for me to say.
Yeah, I mean, it's great that they're finding ways to recover this. I think it's interesting that, you know, that Apple and a lot of like tech people are starting to talk about like tablets as primary computing devices. And that the desktop PC is dead. But if you really believe that you're going to have these things always like kind of sync to a home PC, that means for every iPad you sell, you're going to sell a desktop. So that tells me that the desktop market is not dead. I don't think you'd have it both ways.
I think you can, because you sync to the cloud.
Well, that's one possibility. But bandwidth is nowhere near what we need it to be to sync, you know, 8 gigabytes of pictures and 30 gigabytes of music.
Right, if you are using it as a primary storage device.
Right, well, but it's got to get there somehow, right? You got to get it. You got to have a way to create the data and publish the data.
Yeah, well, the getting music and stuff, if you're talking about music to listen to, that's coming from the cloud or from your CDs or something like that. So that doesn't matter. You don't worry about losing that. Creating photographs or something like that, photographs or movies, is the big gap, I think, in seeking to the cloud.
That's
the big gap. You know, things that you write, emails and blog posts and stuff like that, those are small enough that you don't really worry about the bandwidth issue. But yeah, right now, pictures and movies and stuff, that's a gap.
And I think the gap's going to continue to stay fairly wide, because the resolution of pictures and the resolution of video continues to climb. And it's always been the latest and greatest video and pictures have been well behind bandwidth, I think, in terms for a whole library of data. So it's just interesting. You know, I think it's interesting on two fronts. One, that hey, there's somebody has found a way to recover this stuff, you know, if you are using it this way. And, you know, right. You never know. Like maybe that's just like you took the picture and you downloaded it to the iPad. I don't know if you can even do that, actually. I guess not
through
yet.
iPhoto.
Right. But, you know, if you couldn't get it back, then, or if it you couldn't, somebody else might be able to.
Yeah. I mean, even if you're syncing it every day, there's always somebody who's going to have a $1,000 idea on their device.
Yeah. And just going back to the earlier point, you know, like you said, normal hard drive recovery, you know, minimum like $5,000 just to get your stuff back. But if somebody can get it from solid state media for $1,000, a lot of new laptops are coming with solid state drives. So that means that hardware recovery or data recovery from those will also be cheaper, because these people have found out a cheap way to do it.
Yeah.
So I think they're also lowering the costs for data recovery in general, whether it's an iPad or not.
Yeah, I think that's going to be the bigger market, is solid state drives in either laptops or desktops.
Definitely. And Ryan, I believe you also have the next article too.
Yeah, so here's another example, I think, of, you know, Apple's My Way or the Highway. On the recent MacBook Airs, maybe, or some of the MacBook Pros, they've been using these new screws. They're a pentalobular design, and this pentalobular screw has 5 sides. It looks a little bit like a flower. It's not a 5-sided Torx, although that is, or I'm sorry, Phillips, 5-sided Phillips. Although a 5-sided Phillips has been known to be able to remove the screws, it actually can damage the screw in the process. But it's interesting that not only is Apple including these on their new devices, if you send your device back for repair and it came originally with normal 4-sided 00 Phillips screws, which are very tiny and hard to take out, but you can probably find an eyeglass screwdriver somewhere that'll fit it. It will return with the 5-sided pentalobular screws, which virtually no one has. In fact, I know that iFixit.com has a kit to remove these and replace them with the 00 Phillips, but they the screwdriver that they're sending with it is actually not a pentalobular screwdriver. It's a five-sided Phillips to remove it.
Yeah, I think the pentalobular is probably patented.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's patented, and I'm not sure if it's owned by Apple, but they seem to have bought up the rights for it.
Yeah, I'm totally adding pentalobular to the Slungcast drinking game. But
It's a really fun word to say.
Yeah, to me, this goes back to the whole satellite operators blowing up the illegal receivers thing, that it's part of the cat and mouse between the hardware manufacturers and stuff. It doesn't bug me too much because it's a physical device and you can get the screw out with some sort of redneck engineering.
Yeah.
Well, here's what bothers me about it. How are people getting into the cases a problem? With every other device ever made, every laptop, every desktop, any computing device, you have always been allowed to open it up and do stuff with it.
Has that always been the case for Apple desktops? Because I don't think it has.
Well, no. Even with app like Mac Pros, you know, the actual desktops, the case still came off.
Well, yeah, but like if you go back the whole way to the original Mac SE, I mean, like that thing had Torx screws, which at that time were pretty. You know,
very rare,
you know, novel, and you needed a like 10-inch long screwdriver to get into there to get it out. I remember actually having to take apart a Mac SE to replace the hard drive. This was long after there were no Apple dealers in the Johnstown area at this time. No one could service it, and I was replacing a hard drive in a friend's computer for it, and I ended up using a straight bit on a very long extension. And it just happened to fit into the six-way Torx screw, and I was able to get them out. But
yeah, I sort of think while a device is under warranty and the users are expecting warranty service, there's some legitimate interest on the manufacturer to detect somebody intruding in the case. I mean, I can be argued either way.
Yeah, I mean, I just go back to if you buy a Dell that comes with a gigabyte of RAM and you want to buy another gigabyte from Crucial, Dell doesn't stop you from putting that in. But Apple was trying to do that.
Yeah, but what can you do to an iPhone or an iPod Touch to service it?
Very true. I was thinking more along the lines of the Air.
A lot of people just want to put a white case on it. I mean, that seems to be like the big thing. They want a white iPhone or they want a pink iPhone. You know, people want to mod their hardware. And I think this is just another example of how the modern thought process among corporations selling hardware and software is that they own this thing. Like, you just bought the right to use it. Like, that's all you really get. Like, you have the
in essence, you're renting it.
You're basically renting it. And I think it follows this model that we don't build user serviceable hardware anymore, and I just don't like it.
Well, I agree we don't build user serviceable hardware, but we get gains from not building user serviceable hardware too, because we now have like surface mount, you know, components and all that stuff that makes things hard to service intrinsically, and that gives us the tiny devices that we enjoy. I mean, if you yank out your pentalobular screws and replace your case with a white case and you go on about your business, Apple's not going to know or care. It's only when you return something for warranty service that they're going to notice that you've done any of this stuff. And I think they have a legitimate interest in that at that point.
Yeah.
That's very, very interesting. I personally don't care because I don't mod my stuff, so...
Yeah, I neither do I.
Yeah, it's no big deal to me. But our next article, we were wondering last week, whenever the announcement of the Verizon iPhone came out and the data plan pricing was not announced, we were wondering, what is it going to be? Well, we finally know. And here's the cool thing. So Verizon is offering a $30 unlimited, although it's capped like every other unlimited plan, for iPhone on Verizon. But the cool thing is, for a limited time, they're letting people, you know, get this unlimited plan before they switch to the tiered pricing. So they're targeting people like me, who are grandfathered into AT&T on the iPhone with an unlimited data plan. If I was to switch to Verizon or just go to a different plan on AT&T, I would lose my unlimited plan and get a 2 gigabyte capped plan. So they're trying to attract all of the grandfather people from AT&T to Verizon, saying, hey, we'll give you the exact same plan you have now for $30 and you'll be grandfathered in, you know, come the next 2 months when we switch to tiered pricing for everybody else. So what do you guys think of this price? About what you thought it was going to be?
Well, I mean, it didn't seem much cheaper. Much, I mean, we're talking like $10 either way here per month. It's like, I mean, I guess it's $120 per year. But I figured that they'd probably offer something to entice the AT&T customers over, you know. But in the end, like, I don't see Verizon. Verizon's not known for their cheap data plans or anything, and they have a very good marketing in the sense that they're able to like push you into the just like the plan right up from where you'd really normally want to buy. You know, like if you go and look at a individual plan without SMS messaging, and you look at the 450 minute plan and the 900 minute plan, there's like $30 difference, and they both include, you know, what is it? Unlimited mobile to mobile and like name five numbers you can call all the time, right? Well, then if you switch to the one with SMS, then the 450 minute plan drops the call five people for free, plus it's only like certain mobile to mobile. You know, they just change it just slightly, so they push you into the upper plan anyway. And I just think that's how Verizon works. So, you know, but the network always works, so I'm happy.
Matt, do you have a smartphone?
No, I have a dumb phone. And
it's a feature phone.
Yeah. It has features. It makes phone calls. it beeps annoyingly at times. The reason I don't have a smartphone has been the cost of the data plans. I'm a Verizon customer. To get a smartphone, I'd be looking at $30 a month. But I would also be looking at $30 for a month for my wife, who has a more legitimate need for a smartphone than I do. So $60 a month for the household, $720 a year extra for smartphones is not something we've done. I got an iPod Touch for Christmas, which I've enjoyed having, and Apple is working its magic on me.
They do that.
Yeah. So along with seeing how depressingly few businesses in our area offer Wi-Fi at their business establishments, you know, sitting at the mechanic, that kind of thing, I always figured I'd find a Wi-Fi signal somewhere, and that generally is not the case. So, yeah, probably iPhone 5 or 6 on Verizon, we'll probably be looking at a pair of those and biting the bullet.
Yeah, that actually happened to me recently whenever my front axle broke and I was sitting at the mechanic shop. I just used my iPhone. You know, I didn't even think twice. It was so nice to surf the net, send emails, you know, do stuff that I would normally do anywhere else. Like, I don't even think of how hard it is to find Wi-Fi around here. Because really, what do you have? Starbucks and McDonald's?
I think, you know, some of the restaurants and stuff offer it too.
Like, do they?
Yeah, Tulum's offers it, and so does
that's true.
The Boulevard Grill, and there's places that do.
Yeah, there's places, but Eden Park doesn't anymore. Not on Scalp.
Oh.
For a while, they had a trial. They were deploying everywhere, and they had it, and it worked great. And then they decided, we're not going to do this anymore.
Huh.
And they yanked it.
Oh, darn.
Yeah. Which seems stupid after you've deployed the infrastructure.
Yeah.
Yeah, really.
Yeah. Yeah, so they don't have it. You know, like Wendy's on Scalp, they don't have it. Places that I would sort of reasonably expect to.
Don't have it.
Yeah.
Well, our next article, Matt, is I believe one of them that you submitted.
Yeah, so this is just funny and sad. You know, a lot of terrorists rig up their bombs to be triggered by SMS messages, and somebody did that and got a spam SMS message. It was a woman, I think. I don't have it in front of me. The terrorist got an SMS trigger. And the bomb went off while she still had the bomb on her person, which was not the intent. And she blew up and nobody else did. So I never thought I would be on here saying good things about an SMS spam message. But if it blows up a terrorist without hurting anyone else, that's about the best spam in the world.
Yeah, it was a lady in Moscow, Russia on New Year's Eve.
Yeah,
and she got a spam SMS message from her cell phone company that said Happy New Year, and that blew her up.
Yeah, you know, when I've always heard about the terrorists using SMS triggered bombs, and I always figured there was a little more engineering involved. Like, it had to come from a certain number or say a certain magic
right.
word.
It's not just any SMS.
Yeah. I was apparently mistaken, and the.
Well, they probably bought, you know, like one of those. What do they call them? The mobile. What are those phones called? You just have like
the
paid
track phones.
Track phones, yeah. Or the paid month by month.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, no one knows this number. Now, who could possibly send me a text message?
And you get the auto dialer.
Yep.
Yeah, and that's funny because, you know, that's how a lot of suicide bombings work, is that the people are trusted to blow themselves up, But if they don't, somebody's watching from a mile away with their cell phone who can make it blow up if they get cold feet. It's just funny that this happened from spam.
Yeah.
And the next article, Matt, you also submitted to.
Yeah, yeah. This is Virgin Mobile, who's a wireless carrier who uses Sprint Network, sells MiFi devices. These are the little wireless hotspots about credit card size that you carry with you, and uses the cellular network to create a little Wi-Fi hotspot. And, you know, all the wireless carriers sell these. Virgin, a while ago, back around August or so of 2010, started advertising a MiFi with an unlimited data plan. And they got a lot of press over this, including David Pogue in the New York Times wrote up the that, hey, Virgin Mobile has a MiFi. It's the same as everyone else's MiFi. But what makes this really special and really great is that it's an unlimited data plan instead of the 5 gigabyte cap that every other carrier had. And I live out in the boonies, and my only real internet option right now is satellite internet, which is a really poor option. I have a 7.5 gigabyte cap. It's expensive. It has high latency. It doesn't work well in bad weather. So my thinking was, I'm going to try this. I'm going to get this for my home because it's, you know, a little bit cheaper. It's a little bit less data, but well, actually, it's not less data. It's unlimited data is what they're advertising.
Right.
The rates are at least as fast. So I'm going to get it. So I got it, and it came, and I didn't have a Sprint signal at my house.
Oh.
Which didn't really surprise me because I hadn't had a Sprint signal when I moved there 4 years earlier. I was hoping they'd build it out a little bit, and the map said they did, but they didn't. So I got this Virgin MiFi device and no signal, and I sent it back. But this whole purchase was predicated on their unlimited data plans. Well, now their unlimited data plan isn't unlimited. It's the same 5 gig cap that everyone else has.
Yeah, everybody is tricking people into this.
Yeah, and they got probably so many customers from national coverage from the New York Times that this is what they were offering, and then they just yanked it out from underneath everyone.
Yeah, this is ridiculous. I mean, what more can we say about this? You know, it seems like every week we have an article where somebody, you know, another company does this, and now Virgin just added their name to the list.
Yep.
So,
and that's the only thing that was differentiating them, too. Why else would you specifically choose Virgin?
Right. Yeah, I mean, I don't know of Virgin being anywhere that other companies or other services aren't.
No, they use Sprint's network.
Yeah.
The difference is that they're you know, month-to-month, no contract, which maybe appeals to some people, but...
All right. So, Virgin, you are along the lines of Verizon and AT&T now. Way to go. And our last article of the day, Ryan, I believe you submitted this one.
Yeah, Ars published a nice little retrospective on the last 3 months with a Windows Phone 7 device. And I think it's a good article. They basically cover, you know, the things that they you know, people didn't like initially with no copy and paste and stuff like that. But, you know, they still give it pretty good marks. They mentioned they still want multitasking, but they think it's a worthwhile device, that it's, you know, it's very intuitive to use, and it shows a lot of promise, you know, the UI. And I think that's what everyone's been saying about it. So, I mean, I honestly still haven't had a chance. Well, I did mess around with a Windows phone that was, like, on display, but you know, I haven't really given an in-depth even myself yet, but... That interface still seems really cool, and I just think everyone should give it a try when they're going to make their next phone purchase.
Yeah, I've heard lots of good things about it, but I haven't seen one in the flesh either.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've seen on Dignation, Alex Albrecht had one, and he was showing how it integrates with everything.
Yeah.
How, you know, your contact list shows you updates from Facebook, and it automatically syncs people's profile pictures so you can see who you're calling, and stuff that just happens without you knowing it. But it's good things.
Yeah, I listened to the Windows Weekly podcast with Paul Theriault, and for months leading up to the Windows Phone 7 release, that's all he was talking about. The first time you fire it up, it gets all your stuff, and it's like magic.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be so nice if every phone did that. Although, I don't know that I would want to open up my contacts and see people's stupid Facebook statuses along with their names in my contact list.
And 80 pictures of infants.
Right. Exactly. Am I calling your infant or am I calling you? I don't know.
You know, I think it is it's a pretty cool feature to have that synced up right on the first try. I mean, my first experience with the cloud, you know, I guess, would be when Google Sync came out and I switched from a Windows phone to a BlackBerry. This is a couple of years ago. But when that happened... I downloaded Google Sync and bam, all my contacts and all my entire calendar was loaded into my phone. And I was just like, wow, like that is the future. I mean, saying that now, obviously it's like, duh, but you know, it,
well, you didn't have the 12 hour setup time that you normally would have had.
Right. You know, there was just work, no fuss, no muss, you know? And I mean, there's still anytime I just installed BlackBerry OS 6 on my phone. And you know, every time you do that, it takes a couple hours to get the phone like rebooted and all that crap. And you know, all your apps registered and installed, but, it's pretty cool that at least the data part of it is starting to catch up. And I think that's a big plus for Microsoft.
Yeah, so maybe we'll see Apple having some real competition, you know, with phones that look as nice and can do the same things. So any of you guys see anything else that happened this week that you want to talk about?
There's the Apple and the Sony bookstore thing. Did you see that?
I heard things about it.
Yeah, so I think this was just in the last day or two. It looks like Sony submitted a ebook reader app to the Apple App Store, the iOS App Store, and Apple rejected it because they don't want Sony offering in-app purchases of ebooks without going through Apple's purchasing mechanisms. But what made it a little bit scarier was that it seemed like maybe you couldn't even purchase ebooks somewhere else, like on your desktop, and have them delivered to your your portable device. And I don't do it a lot, but I've gotten Kindle books on my iPod Touch.
I just did that today.
Yeah. And I think that's a big selling point, especially for people who own a Kindle device and then happen to have an iPhone, and they just want to maybe read a little bit when they're you know, stuck somewhere. So it's not real clear right now where this is going, if Apple is going to prevent delivery of Sony books and Kindle books to the applications if they weren't purchased with Apple getting a cut or not. But that's something I'm going to be looking at in the next few weeks, I'm sure.
Yeah, that's ridiculous. I hope they don't do that. I mean, Ryan, do you read, or do you have any mobile devices that you read on?
I don't know how to read.
Oh, well, that would be a problem.
No, I was kidding. I do read a lot. I don't read fiction at all, really. I mainly read mostly like technology and historical related stuff. So it's like, you know, I actually do a lot of reading on Google books online, all their open source content or public domain content. But getting back to like how Apple handles these purchases and stuff, I think the thing that Apple's going to have to watch out for is that while yes, they own the store, technically they own the store. It's like, oh, I own, I own this little storefront and I sell widgets to people. So it's a private property and the government really doesn't have much say. The thing that Apple's sort of traipsing into is not so much that they're a market, but they're a marketplace. Like, they're not a store. They're an entire, like, they're a playing field, you know, for everyone to interact on. And this is probably going to open them up to regulation. And if they're not careful, they're going to attract more attention and ruin it for themselves, like to the point where it won't be as good as it was, and it will be, the profits from it will be divvied up in so many ways that it probably wouldn't be as profitable had it been if they just would have been a little bit less controlling.
Yeah, and what bugs me too is the capriciousness of it. You know, what Amazon's been doing has been fine so far, and maybe tomorrow it won't be.
Yeah.
And maybe I bought my device counting on that functionality.
Right. And they didn't do anything wrong. They didn't change anything. It's just right. All of a sudden, new rule, done.
And Apple says, well, that rule's always been there. It's just, well, now we'll enforce it.
Right.
Right. And I guess the analogy is that if somebody sells books, like they can't come and disable your books or disable your method of reading the books or whatever. It's like you own, if I buy an automatic page turner, the automatic page turner is always going to work for my hardware book, you know. But if I buy some reader for my books that's on iPhone, that it may not work someday, and that's just not fair.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, I totally agree. So any other news stories? Ryan, did you see anything happening this week that we didn't cover?
No, not really.
Yeah, I think we did a good job of being up to the date this week.
Yeah, yeah. It only took us 2 hours.
Yeah, 2 hours and 14 minutes. So that's all we have for this week's Slongcast. As usual, you can find me on Facebook and Twitter. My username is Slongcack. Ryan, where can people find you if they want to find out about you?
I'm on Facebook at /RyanLancey and Twitter @RyanLancey.
Oh, so you're no longer on the internet too. You moved since last week.
What do you mean?
Last week you told everybody you were on internet too and they couldn't contact you.
That's right, yes. No, I have moved back.
And Matt, if people want to find out about you, where would they go?
You can read my blog, Scotch Tape and Duct Whiskey, at ductwhiskey.com. That's ductwhisky.com. Or on Twitter as Coneslayer, Coneslayer.
I love the title of your blog. I think that's great.
Actually, I have a blog too. I don't know if I've ever mentioned it.
I think you did once, but go ahead and mention it again.
It's Lancipedia at blogspot.com.
Okay, so
blogspot. Spot. Yes.
Just do a Google search for a Lancipedia, and
yeah,
I'm sure you'll find it.
Yeah, I think it's the first hit. Spelled with an I, crazily enough. Don't ask me why.
So if you want to submit a story for us to talk about next week's episode will be 22. So just bookmark it on Delicious, Slongcast022, and have a wonderful Tuesday evening.